Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
There is a peaceful solution called peace revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it, so let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it, and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America. And when the war is over and we've won it, let's remember how we done it, so we don't have to do it again. There is a peaceful solution called the peace revolution. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life and relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. If you're a new listener, this podcast acts as a virtual classroom for adults, designed to point out and provide useful perspectives, resources, and information. Each episode contains a subject of study essential to a comprehensive understanding of reality, all of which is focused on providing you with the history, context, references, and the various methods and tools so that you can learn for yourself that which public schools cannot afford to provide. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial-free and presented free to the public thanks to the generosity of the subscribers to the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. As always, I encourage you to check the episode notes, the references, and the links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community and learn how to apply this journey of discovery to your everyday life. If, after studying the episode notes, you're looking to learn more, Peace Revolution also has several excellent partner podcasts, which likewise feature commercial-free educational episodes free to the public, including CorbettReport.com, GnosticMedia.com, MediaMonarchy.com, RemedyRadio.com, The Unplugged Mom Podcast, and many others, each of which uniquely fills the void left by public schooling and mainstream media. This is the fourth installment of a very special interview episode series of Peace Revolution, featuring the gentle tone, scholarly insights, and wealth of wisdom that combines in the form of John Taylor Gatto, the legendary educator, author, and icon of liberty, who offers a lifetime of perspectives on the origins, intentions, and ultimate destiny of the compulsory public school system. The audio for this episode is taken from the fourth hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, and it's very dense. So I'm going to cut straight to the point and skip the usual introduction. I'm joined once again by Paul Verge, Jan Irvin, Kevin Cole, Tony Myers, and Lisa Arborcheski, and together we'll be providing you with the historical analysis, the contextual connections, the references, and the other artifacts which will help you gain a better grasp and truly appreciate the momentous discoveries embedded herein. This is episode 44, The Ultimate History Lesson with John Taylor Gatto, Hour 4 plus commentary. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
It's all good for right now. Some won't be up there. I just wanted to make sure. That was loud and clear. All right. First, I would like to present you with a book. Not that you don't have enough books, but this particular book was written by a friend of Thomas Becket, and he wrote it for Thomas Becket. For Thomas Becket didn't have, in this author's opinion, enough intellectual self-defense to do what he was doing, and he was trying to help him out. And his name is John of Salisbury, and it was written in the 12th century. And I thought, if there was such a thing as reincarnation, this guy reminds me of you, and that you would greatly enjoy this.
I will read it with pleasure.
12th century defense.
Thank you, Rich.
Of logic and reason. In a time of irrationality. And I took the liberty of, just in the prologue, I marked a couple pages there that has some, there's a couple quotes in there where he basically lays out why he's doing it. I thought, you know, I got a chuckle out of it. And I thought, you could always use a good laugh now and then.
This will be the very next thing I read.
All right, now I have one last bit of housekeeping. Let me see. If you could read that to the camera while, at the same time, holding this mug, and it'll be the intro for the episode. Or you could change it however you like.
Give me the eye sign. Hi, I'm John Taylor Gatto, and this is What You've Been Missing.
Awesome. Yesterday, the name of R. Gordon Wasson came up, and you raised your eyebrows. What does that name mean to you?
Well, it means to me Soma, the magic mushroom, and that Wasson wasn't some fringe nut, but some Wall Street heavy hitter. So I read it with great pleasure, not once, but until it fell apart.
Before you leave today, I have a DVD for you. I just have to burn it. I have the folder made and everything. And in there, I put Wasson's Russia Mushrooms and History book, which is very hard to find on PDF. So I just thought you'd get a kick out of it.
I will get a big kick out of it.
What does the name Anthony Sutton mean to you?
Actually, I corresponded briefly with Sutton. He made the contact after he read Underground History. And his books about the rise of Wall Street and the rise of the Soviet Union and Wall Street and the rise of Nazism were important parts in a slow process of overcoming my own skepticism. I mean, I had all the pieces. I had many of the pieces, rather. But they seemed to add up to a reality that I could find no hint of recognition of. And in the copious reading I had done and kept current, why weren't there any references to this at all? Or occasionally when someone like Ramsey Clark would seem to breach the wall of security, Ramsey was toast. He was marginalized. No one ever mentioned Ramsey again. He wasn't a guest on any show.
Well, the same thing happened to Sutton, because he worked for the Hoover Institute at Stanford University, which is very prestigious. And then once they started reading his work, they're like, you can't write this. And he said, that's the ticket out of here. I must go find out what's going on. And I think he wrote like nine or more books on these various subjects. And when you see how Wall Street funded the Bolsheviks and Wall Street was funding the Nazis and the Bushes and the Harrimans and all those families that were also eugenicists and the ones that want to do compulsory schooling and tell you what to do with your kids and all these other things, like there's a very small knit group. And once you try to understand the philosophy of what makes them the utopia that are trying to shape everyone else's lives and violate their volition, I thought it was like it's overwhelming to discover that. But then you discover someone like Lysander Spooner or Frederick Bastiat and read the book The Law, and it's so simple. And yet if you don't understand the simplicity, it's easy for these other groups to take it away from us.
Yes, very easy to marginalize as who has time for this nonsense. I mentioned in our session yesterday that as I was poking around in, for other reasons, in the history of American adoption, I kept running into the people who were the architects of American schooling. And I said, what possible correspondence. The chapter in Underground History, Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede, is actually a kind of lens into my brain trying to prove to myself there was some sense in following this road. If the heirs of the people who fought at Runnymede had maintained an 850-year continuity, and then I found other organizations that had, I said, it's possible that someone with an agenda other than this. So,
who was Ignatius Loyola?
Well, Loyola was the founder of the Army of Jesus, the Jesuits who penetrated the Reformation and eventually produced the phenomenon history records as the Counter-Reformation. They slowed the momentum down because the Reformation really is founded, although Calvin is the eminence grise, Luther's every man his own priest is this wild declaration of radicalism. To get rid of the religious priesthood is to get rid of all middlemen, yes.
There were many countries that outlawed the Jesuits in the late 1700s, and one of those was the province or electorate of Bavaria. And then there was a Jesuit professor of canon law named Adam Weishaupt, right, who created a group. And what influence specifically has that group had on the education system?
Well, to pursue that line would require so many illusions. I prefer not to enter an area where I can't field the hardest questions with substantive facts, but certainly the sense of powers behind the scenes, very, very strong. Let me give you a few specifics. It's been clear since the beginning of standardized testing that the tests do not predict. And the best American, the most prestigious American universities have either dismissed it or kept it in pro forma place. But actually, as Harvard and Princeton told me, it's not a significant determinant. They just don't want to rock the boat that holds, the glue that holds this pyramid together. They don't predict, then why is 10% of the school year and school budget devoted to exerting stress on so many millions of people and through the children, their families? And why do so many innocently ignorant school teachers say this will determine your future when it only does if you convince yourself that it determines your future? It has no predictive power at all other than to signal this is someone who will memorize whatever you ask him to memorize. This is a useful skill, an anti-skill.
In the book, The Leipzig Connection, Basics in Education, toward the end of the book, after talking about Pestalozzi, it talks about Pestalozzi's mentor, who was Johann Caspar Lavater, who was working and experimenting on Swiss lower privileged children in a universal schooling system. He was also a grand master of the Illuminati. So since Pestalozzi and Lavater and all these other key figures that were in the Prussian education system,
yeah,
were also members of the Prussian Illuminati, it just seemed natural to see the takeover and undermining of nationhood of our society, the taking away of our identity through the school system is also making we as a nation incoherent. And it just seems like there is a very militaristic strategy that's been in place a long time.
And notice what the specific mechanism is. It's an artificial extension of childhood. Theoretically to the grave, but certainly beyond the point where learning anything is easy. As long as you indulge childish fears and childish appetites long enough, you've effectively rendered somebody harmless. You know, you can see it in its crudest form in the military, in the training of recruits, or in fraternities in the hazing of freshmen. But actually, yesterday I hope we talked about Richard Branson and the turning point of his life at age 4 when his mother drops him miles from home. Throughout most of human history, anywhere on the planet, childhood is over by the age of 7, and even in the most permissive cultures, it's over by the age of 11 or 12. People are, even in our own country, at the beginning of the 20th century, a substantial number of young women at the age of 13 were married or becoming married. I'm thinking in particular of, I'm thinking of a 18-volume History of the World that used to be, for 20 years, the premium of Book of the Month Club, written by a husband and wife team. And still, a rather respectable history. In an inside historians say it's not bad history. It's very, very...
They also do a history of philosophy set?
Yes.
I have it. Gino Denning just sent it to me last week. I just scanned it in. It's on my desk if you want to go get it. There's like...
All we need is the last name, and it'll trigger... In any case, the fellow who had been trained, I think, at UChicago as a historian, marries his wife, who becomes his co-writer and...
Will Durant.
Will Durant and Ariel. Ariel was either 13 or 15. There's a dispute on the internet about how she wasn't older than 15, and I suspect she was 13 when they married. Was Will some form of sexual oppressor? No. Instead of going to junior high school, Ariel studied professional historiography and its protocols. And she was a full partner in the writing, and Will died, predeceased her 10 years, and she continued to lecture, having begun her productive life when people began their productive lives. To extend this to the late teens or beyond the late teens is to fly in the face of the first admiral in American history being in charge of a warship.
Farragut.
Farragut at the age of 12. Or George Washington being the surveyor of Culpeper County, Virginia in his mid-teens.
Very entrepreneurial attitudes that they
Or got. Jefferson running a plantation, his parents both dead, 250 employees. He's 12 or 13. But these examples go on and on and on. Why have we marginalized the young who, whatever they lack in experience, more than make up for in resilience, in acuity? They bring new eyes to old situations, which is the secret of scientific invention. So it's done because they're the most dangerous. They're the least overlaid with these conditioning, and of course that must have been understood way, way back in history. Alexander the Great, after all.
You're observing that values have changed since the time of our founding fathers, who were literate, autonomous, entrepreneurial. They also grew hemp. They knew the value of hemp.
Come on, George Robert, he did it for medicinal purposes, so I assume it wasn't.
And Jefferson traveled the planet collecting different strains, and they had contests, and they wrote letters about their, you know, hey, I've grown this strain, and it does this, and they're like competing. And so the fact that you're not taught about this in school, and the role that hemp played in making the sails and the clothing and everything was hemp dependent.
Oh, it's a miraculous fiber. There are some rather sober accounts of the lengths to which the Hearst family went, because they were the largest forest owners in the country. They supplied the wood pulp for newspapers, but hemp newspapers are infinitely superior to wood pulp, so that they moved heaven and earth to create the narrative of reefer madness.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution. This is episode 44, the fourth hour of the ultimate history lesson, a weekend with John Taylor Gatto. And in this first 15 minutes, John covers so much that I think that we really need to comprehensively have a group conversation to kind of flesh out the multiple points to be sure that we don't leave anything unsaid, so that we can let the audience leave nothing unread.
Speaking of unsaid...
We'll leave that pun for like 5 minutes from now. But John starts out with John of Salisbury in the Metallogicon, the 12th century defense of logic and the trivium. This is all pre-assassination of Thomas Becket. John of Salisbury is a friend of Thomas Becket's. There's interesting history. There's a couple interesting movies that you might want to check out on Thomas Becket. The idea is that this is a recurring theme through history, and by learning about this one event that happened in the 12th century, you can see the patterns of history that are still ongoing today. Then moved into the question of R. Gordon Wasson. Who is this enigmatic author and ex-J.P. Morgan associate of Wall Street? What role does he possibly play in our education system? And John mentions that he happened to have read one of Wasson's books until it fell apart. And then mentions that he specializes in propaganda and spin doctoring for Wall Street banker J.P. Morgan and company. And there's also the Life magazine from 1957, May 13th, 1957, in which the discovery of mushrooms that cause strange visions was printed, this article that opened many people's minds. And then there's also Wasson's association in another Life magazine article mentioning this thing called the Century Club. So I'd like to find out more about that.
Perhaps Jan can offer some context on the question, who is R. Gordon Wasson?
Who was R. Gordon Wasson? R. Gordon Wasson, or Robert Gordon Wasson, was a vice president for J.P. Morgan Bank, going from J.P. Morgan's Guarantee Trust Company in the 1930s into J.P. Morgan Bank itself, working at 23 Wall Street, a.k.a. The Corner. And I forget who Wasson took over for. There was somebody that was there before him who was in charge of PR, but he died, and then Wasson took over as the vice president of PR, or public relations. Now, Wasson was affiliated for 10 years with a guy by the name of Edward Bernays, who wrote a book called Propaganda. This is probably who, in fact, trained Wasson in the arts of PR, public relations, and he started out as a journalist, went to, I believe, Columbia University, and then went to Oxford, and came back and decided to become, or I don't know actually if he went to Oxford, anyway, he went to Columbia, but he came back and decided to get into banking, and that's when he supposedly got his way into J.P. Morgan Bank through Guarantee Trust Company. What it appears actually took place, though, is that Wasson used his journalism skills and his newly refined skills in PR and false rhetoric to cover up a story, or to bury a story, that had caused a lot of trouble for J.P. Morgan Sr., which was the Hall Carbine Affair. And the Hall Carbine Affair was an instance in the Civil War where J.P. Morgan Sr. bought a lot of discarded Hall carbine guns from the United States government for a dollar or two apiece, and then sold them back to the U.S. government at a significant profit for about $20 a piece, and this is in Civil War money values. And then this is where supposedly it's claimed that where J.P. Morgan Sr. Got his wealth from to start his banking empire. Now, it appears that Wasson was the guy who was hired to PR all of that and to cover it all up. Now, I have the original letters between Gordon Wasson and Alan Nevins. Nevins is the one of the historians that J.P. Morgan hired to cover all of this up. And I have the private letters between Wasson and Nevins specifically discussing what Nevins should say, how Nevins should answer to newspaper articles and things like that. And then at the same time, on the other side, Wasson is sitting there pointing to these newspaper articles, bragging about how, see, even this historian agrees with my point of view, never mind that I have the letters of Wasson telling this historian everything to say on the backside that nobody can see there. Wasson is the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms. Now, in my own researches, I've discovered that Wasson took a lot of the core theories of this from a guy by the name of John G. Bork, who wrote a book on the scatologic rites of all nations, 1891 or 1892, and that this is really the foundation of where Wasson got his ideas from. And we're told this whole story that Wasson and his wife went through this walk on their honeymoon in New York, and that Wasson's wife ran off into the woods and started picking mushrooms. But even Wasson's daughter, Masha, admits in a book called The Sacred Mushroom Seeker that she doesn't really buy into this whole story. So what's interesting, though, is this whole promotion of the magic mushrooms from the Mazatec Indians, specifically Maria Sabina, it was a PR promotion by the Council on Foreign Relations and by J.P. Morgan Bank and the wealthy elite, including guys like C.D. Jackson, who is the head of U.S. Psychological Warfare, Henry P. Davison and Henry Luce, both Skull and Bones. Henry Luce was in charge of Time Life magazine, where Wasson published his 1957 article, Seeking the Magic Mushroom. So all of this ties in together, creating a very tidy little package of mind control. Now, what, you know, most people don't want anybody to know in the psychedelic research community is that Wasson was a chairman for the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was very close friends with Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, and in fact regularly had lunch with the guy. But, you know, and we're told that this whole story, that all of these, you know, if you want to believe in coincidence theory, we're told that, you know, Wasson just happened to have a chance meeting with Henry Luce, and he was going to publish originally the Magic Mushroom article in National Geographic, but because of this chance meeting, he published with Luce. Well, Luce's wife, Claire Booth Luce, is quoted as saying that her husband, Henry Luce, did more to popularize LSD than Timothy Leary. And, of course, Henry Luce being the president and CEO of Time Life magazine. Now, this goes on to another trail. This guy, Henry Luce, is also the guy who stored in his vault the famous Zapruder film from the Kennedy assassination. Now, who acquired the Zapruder film but Henry Luce's vice president, who was, as I just mentioned a minute ago, a guy by the name of C.D. Jackson, who is the head of U.S. Psychological Warfare. Now, C.D. Jackson went to Abe Zapruder to get the Zapruder film. Abe Zapruder's employee was George Demoranshield's wife. And George Demoranshield was, of course, assassinated over the Kennedy assassination. George Demoranshield happened to work directly with Wasson on the Russian student funds and things like that, which were secret CIA covert operations for the U.S. government.
That's where they brought in Oswald.
And that's where they brought in Oswald. So it looks like Demoranshield, probably with the help of Wasson and maybe Wasson's wife, Valentina Pavlovna Wasson, who was part of the Russian intelligentsia, brought Oswald into the country. Now, you know, there's still some loose ends and, you know, regarding the Kennedy assassination and Wasson's involvement with it. But this character Wasson, not only is he the pioneer of the psychedelic revolution and the 60s hippie movement and all of this stuff, but, you know, they were using the bankers, J.P. Morgan Bank, and J.P. Morgan Sr., by the way, was, I have documentation that he was investigating the history of magic mushrooms back in the 1850s. And so, you know, there's the elites are using the psychedelics for in two different ways. And psychedelics can be used for mind control purposes when they're used by somebody who doesn't have critical thinking skills like the trivium and quadrivium. And when they are shocked out of the current system of or the current system of reality or the checks and balances that they have in place to keep people under their control, when people break free of that with the psychedelic experience, then what they can do is they can use somebody like Timothy Leary or whomever it may be to plug in wrong or misleading information or a new age cult like 2012 or this sort of thing, like you know, like Daniel Pinchbeck does. So, you know, what they realized is that they could use psychedelics for the negative mind control aspect to mislead people rather than for the enlightening aspects that psychedelics are known for when used in proper combination with something like the trivium and quadrivium.
Now, just to clarify, since I brought up Oswald's name, I don't think any of us believe that Oswald was the lone assassin that he's made out by our public schooling system. But I would like to note about this guy, C.D. Jackson and Wasson, psychological warfare. That's what the assassination was. It's a psychological warfare media event where everything's controlled. Can you speak a little bit to why someone like C.D. Jackson or Wasson might be close to that whole public event in history?
I'm sorry, restate that, Rich.
Oh, I'm just observing that since Wasson was trained by Bernays and employed by one of the biggest banking families to do some of the biggest cover-ups, and he's so close to Henry Luce and C.D. Jackson and the Kennedy assassination itself, what role, like, we're taught in public school that Oswald was this lone assassin and he didn't really have any help and all these things went down.
Sure,
when
right.
you actually examine the evidence, you find psychological warfare all over it, which means you have to look close at it.
It's Wasson is there really to help PR everything. And Kennedy had just signed, Bill 1110 into effect, which would have essentially brought about the end of the Federal Reserve as we know it today, 40 years ago, and also brought about the end of the CIA. And so these are two key things. Wasson is close friends with Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, who is...
Well, and the CIA was designed to be, it was Cold War, and it was supposed to be external, and it wasn't carrying out its mandate according to what Kennedy was seeing it doing.
Right, so here is Alan Dulles, Wasson's closest friend, or one of Wasson's close friends, losing his job. And I think that all of these guys got together, the bankers and... these other people working through, working with Russia and everything else just to get Kennedy out of the way. Now, somebody mentioned earlier, what could Wasson and these people have to do with education? Now, there's this book by Diamond published by Oxford University. And if I could find the date here, it was published in 1992 by Oxford University. And it's called Compromised Campus.
Sigmund Diamond.
And on page 71, Diamond states, quote, what Kluckholm and Gardner called, quote, the public relations problem facing the center, end quote, could be handled first by enlisting the cooperation of important members of the Harvard faculty and recruiting able people from the outside, like Harold Berman of Stanford Law School and Alexander Gershenkron from Berkeley and the Federal Reserve Board, second, by a joint strategy in which it was Harvard's responsibility to serve as the primary source of information, quote unquote, while Carnegie would confine itself to a curt, quote unquote, no comment. Finally, the quote unquote public relations problem would be helped by a series of small dinners at which President Conant and officials of the center would solicit the advice of the, quote, moral teaching of the best men of the country, end quote. Charles Darlard suggested to Kluckholm and Conant that Conant host the following guests in New York: Arthur Ballantyne, Alan Dulles, Brooks Emeny, Walter Gifford, Devereux C. Josephs, Nicholas Kelly, Roy Larson, Walter Malloroy, Charles Mertz, Arthur Page, Jeffrey Parsons, Robert Patterson, Geroid Robinson, and Gordon Wasson. Kluckholm began to make the necessary arrangements with Conant and also suggested that to Dullard that the documents describing the work of the center be sent to Alan Dulles and other people whom you suggested be invited by Conant. And it goes on from there. But
well,
so
I'm pretty sure that Gatto later in this hour talks about James Bryan Conant, who was a president of Harvard University and during the war was a poison gas specialist and did all these nefarious things, I would say, in the name of his country.
Right.
So
promoted nuclear energy, was a major propagandist for various maneuvers.
Right. And so, you know, and here we have this guy, you know, and here's Wasson tied in with Bernays, tied in with all of these other people. See, Wasson was basically a Russian spy, and Wasson was in charge of promoting the Orthodox Church for the Russian Orthodox Church for Russian defectors and creating Russian.
Well, he's just part of the team that plays on both sides.
Hold on, and he was involved in creating Russian student facilities at various colleges and universities around the country to promote Russian studies, so that they could bring in CIA spies and things like that. Wasson and George de Morenshield's brother were in charge of this stuff. And so, you know, there is a very tight-knit group of these people all working to manipulate education, manipulate the whole background of things, get Kennedy out of the way, bring out this whole psychedelic movement, because the psychedelic movement, without critical thinking, promoted Plato's utopia that they're striving for, this whole New World Order idea without borders and everything.
Hey, Jan, let me ask you, this George de Morenshield you're referencing, would this be the same guy that repeatedly wrote letters to a certain CIA officer named George H.
Yeah. Well, see, there was a couple of phone numbers that were found in George de Morenshield's pocket when he was suicided with a shotgun. But anyway, two of the names that were found in his the phone book that were in his pocket were two guys by the name of George H. W. Bush and R. Gordon Wasson.
Hmm. I don't know if you've read Family of Secrets, but it actually contains the letters from one George to another. I highly recommend people check that out.
The Russ Baker book?
Yes, the Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years.
I'll put it in the notes.
I have not seen that, but would you copy that and send me those pages?
Yeah, I can do that. He does reference knowing Lee Harvey Oswald prior to the fact, and he contacts George H.W. Bush, and initially he says, "I really don't know this guy." But then he continues to correspond with him back and forth using his first name and saying how sorry he is that he can't help you, how it can't help him at this time. So I just was curious if that was the same de Morenshield you were referencing there. So
it
I
is.
Think it is.
Oh, yeah, the one and only. And then what was de Morenshield's brother's name? Dmitri von Morenshield is the brother's name. And one of them changed his name to de Morenshield, but von Morenshield was a professor in charge of the Russian studies programs, right, that Wasson was helping create and fund and work through. And then George de Morenshield was the brother who brought Oswald in. So they're all working together, you know, and then, of course, Wasson's wife, Valentina, was a Russian intelligentsia working, you know, so they definitely had connections going from all sides. And, it looks like, you know, very likely the whole thing that we were even fighting against Russia was a fraud. It was probably just the elites putting together a whole storyline for the masses from top to bottom.
Jan, lastly, I just wanted to mention, it's a minor point, but you had mentioned Wasson's education earlier, and I was online, according to Harvard University's website and the R. Gordon Wasson archives, under his biography, it reads that he did, in fact, attend Columbia's School of Journalism, and then he received the first Pulitzer Traveling Scholarship awarded.
That's right. I had forgotten about that. Thank you.
And studied at the London School of Economics.
Yes, thank you. And, of course, we also shouldn't forget to mention Wasson's brother, Thomas C. Wasson, who was assassinated in 1948 or 1949 in Israel, and he was the first ambassador to Israel. And they tried to cover it up to make it look like the Arabs had assassinated him, or the Palestinians had, but it later came out that the Zionist Jews had assassinated Thomas C. Wasson. And by the way, Thomas C. Wasson looks identical to Gordon Wasson.
That's Thomas Campbell Wasson, right?
Yes.
When you spoke about the Cold War and the possibility that it didn't happen, now we're getting into the next question that I asked Gatto, which is, who is Anthony Sutton? Because among Anthony Sutton's myriad, he covered diamonds, gold, the Cold War, he covered skull and bones. Like, he was really going through trying to verify for himself, because he, as a professor at Stanford University, stumbled across the same trail that Gatto later stumbles across. And so Sutton has left his trail of breadcrumbs and what he found, the books that got him ousted from Stanford, which were how Western technology was being used to build up Soviet Russia. And from discovering that, you know, U.S. taxpayers were actually funding the creation of our enemy. Stanford's like, well, you can't tell people about this. So then he goes and continues his studies, much the same as Gatto later, as he describes the daughters of the barons of Runnymede. That's another continuation of some one of these trails you stumble across that we're not taught about that goes contradictory to what we're being taught in public schools. So I would mention Sutton's book, America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones by Professor Anthony C. Sutton. But the fact that most of the content in that book was inspired by Charlotte Iserby, who's famous for writing The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, but it was her husband, her grandfather, her father, all these archives that she stumbled across, which kind of scared her, and she sent them off to Anthony Sutton for analysis, and Sutton ends up writing this book on Skull and Bones based on the artifact. I also know that Aaron Dykes has spent about the last 10 months editing his footage from his interview with Charlotte Iserby. I'm greatly anticipating that because I think there's a lot to learn from crossing the streams of what Gatto's laying out here in the Ultimate History Lesson as opposed to what Iserby's put out in her various works.
Charlotte Iserby's husband, Jan Iserby, and his ties to the Belgian royal family and the creation of the Belgian state and the African blood diamonds and all of that?
Well, these are all things, thankfully, since Aaron did that comprehensive interview with Charlotte and has spent so long doing the value-added inserts of photos and text and other videos to build it out, that we will shortly, in the coming weeks, be able to sit down and see several hours of all this analysis. Because when Charlotte does that interview, the parts that I've seen so far, she does refer to her husband. And when you look up who her husband was and what family he came from and what they were a part of, it's a very, very intriguing history of how she, by luck of God, ends up in Africa at this time in the Belgian Congo and all these different things that are going on that, you know, she, from her own characterizations, it was God placing her. But it seems like she was in the midst of an intelligence family web that was just inserting other family members into positions of
And of
influence.
Course, after that, she later became worked for the U.S. Board of Education.
Department of Education.
So, and here, you know, see, I had tried to interview Charlotte Iserby for my show about almost a year ago, and she refused to come on my show because I'm not Christian or Catholic. And so I'm very happy to hear that this interview is getting out, and I have, you know, some serious questions about Charlotte's background myself.
Well, the point being that Charlotte's written a composition that's like 700 pages on the deliberate dumbing down of America, which also pertains to the education system from a different perspective. So it's useful information to sort through and filter out. But the fact that she provides this content to Anthony Sutton, and that after John writes The Underground History of American Education, Sutton gets in contact with him. I would imagine this is around 2001, 2002, because Sutton passes away shortly after that. And so just the confluence of these streams of research between reading Sutton's books over the years and then reading John's books over the years, they are so complementary. You need to read John's books to understand why you didn't know about Sutton's books in the first place. Otherwise, these things should be taught in school as history, because what Sutton is writing down, like much like Quigley, it's a history book, and you need to read a history book that hasn't been presented to you in a public school if you would hope to understand what's going on in the world. And then as part of John overcoming his skepticism, because there's no official trail for this information, and it's all over the place, and even though John had been a prolific reader, it had somehow escaped his comprehension until a certain point where he just started now seeing that it's everywhere. And you can go and get these archives and check this out, and nobody's talking about it, and why isn't anyone talking about it? And why is a high school teacher left to beat the drum, as he says, right? So it's all about, once you recognize these things, trying to substantiate it for yourself and going through your own overcoming your skepticism process, because we're not taught about this, so it doesn't seem like it could be real. And yet, when you go out and actually check, it's all over the place.
Now, did anybody else have any concerns regarding some of the presentation that Charlotte laid out in her book compared to John Taylor Gatto's? Because I find much more evidence in Gatto's presentation and a lot of just going nowhere repetition in the first 400 or 500 pages.
I just think your expectations are too high. I look at them as those books as resources, and I'm looking for useful information. I can find useful information in almost any book. Some books have more noise than signal. John's book happened to have a very high signal-to-noise ratio and be very easy to read, very poetic prose that easily flows in your mind and helps you kind of build out these picturesque understandings as opposed to a lesser version of the stories.
Right, and some of these recent conflicts of interest aside that, you know, I don't really know the all of the facts on yet. I will admit, I think that she's put a lot of resources out there that are immensely valuable. Where I found books that she's listed on her website that have led me to other books that have identified the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable group going back to the 1940s. So it could be, you know, I mean,
she's also got the Reese Committee hearing transcripts. She had bought those and acquired those and got them up online. So, and I know her son has done a good job getting the website and offering information out there. So I think it's complimentary because this ultimate history lesson is not the end of anyone's education. It's a first step. And it's just kind of a map to let you know what exists, what's out there.
If you guys don't have doubts about her, I mean, just my own inquiries with her and the way that she badmouths John Taylor Gatto without substantiation, which I have record of primary. But, you know, feel free to delete this whole part about her and my questioning. I just have doubts about her ethics.
I think comparing their work, you know, John's work stands on its own and speaks for itself. I don't think that, you know.
I think his characterizations that I've heard
weren't accurate, so it's right. not a big
I think
deal,
his but. Work is much stronger than hers, actually, and I think that there's probably an agenda there on why she would be talking it down.
Right. Well, it also could be that she's, you know, she finds herself in a unique situation of having seen a lot of this stuff firsthand, and she's trying to figure out a way to put that information out there. And until somebody can get her on record with these questions, like, I feel it's pointless for us to, like, soil the beginning of this awesome interview with, like, I definitely have questions about her too. I just think that, like, fueling the fire to that conflict is antithetical to, you know, like, getting people to look at the information that Gatto puts out.
That Gatto puts out, but if they get through Charlotte's work first, shouldn't we flush that out, you know,
sure? I totally think we should, but I don't know. I guess I would need to see more of the information. I totally have questions about her, especially on, you know, the lineage of the information she's presented. And obviously she comes from a Roman Catholic background, very strict, and she's got these hang-ups and whatever. I mean, I don't know the lady. I'm just saying that, like, I feel like, you know, if there is an interview coming out, like, in a week or so or something that may or may not have some of this stuff in there, it may be advantageous for us to, like, you know, maybe formulate some questions and send to her, like, hey, can you explain why you were in the Congo at the time of all this stuff going down, and what was the role of, you know, whatever, and we can
right. And I also see a bit of irony of a Catholic promoting the Catholic agenda against the New World Order teaching and dumbing Americans down when we got the Dark Ages from the Catholics. So it just seems like a bit of irony and thoughtlessness there.
John then talks about American adoption and American public schooling, and then he keeps in his research of these independent areas, seemingly independent areas, he keeps running into these same crowds of people and asking the question, what possible correspondence could there be? But it's only understand it, you know, you can only understand it after you comprehend the true agenda behind public schooling and the true agenda behind American adoption and these different things. And then he's talking about running into, you know, these different groups that have continuity through time, like the Daughters of the Barons at Runnymede, which is an unbroken chain of influence spanning centuries, starting with the Magna Carta and these barons challenging King John on the field of Runnymede and basically laying down this new law that individuals have rights and that the king's not super, you know, all powerful, that he has to also yield to these barons. I then asked him about Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Society of Jesus, better known as the Jesuits. Now, Loyola originates in Spain, and his family and friends were part of this Alumbrados secret society, which was a forerunner to the Bavarian Illuminati. There's also a Venice connection to the Reformation, funding of Luther, which is Protestantism, and the Counter-Reformation, which was headed up by Loyola, carried out by the Jesuits. So Tony spent the past 2 weeks studying this 1992 document by Webster Tarpley, and I was thinking maybe he could say a few words about the connections between the Venetian black nobility, Luther and the Reformation, and Loyola and the Jesuits.
Well, to explain all this would take an extremely long amount of time, but with the time given, I'll try to sum up what I can to show how a lot of these different ideas lead into a lot of these different secret societies and build out over time. So first, I'm going to read from The Hiram Key by Christopher Knight and Robert Lomas. And on page 336, it states, "A more reliable document is the Wood manuscript, written in 1610, the same year as Galileo first discovered his views on the structure of the solar system, on vellum in the form of 8 strips folded to give 16 leaves with 32 pages. It starts by identifying the sciences with which masonry has always been associated, which are given as grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. These are the ancient classical subjects lost in the Christian world during the Dark Ages. They have been recognized again from the 10th century onward through contact with Arab scholars in Spain, Sicily, and North Africa, and Greek thinkers in Constantinople. Amongst other things, the lost works of Aristotle had been rediscovered. In addition, Arabic scientific and mathematical works were translated for Western use. By the beginning of the 17th century, they were again the natural subjects of all educated people and were in no way peculiar to Freemasonry." And what's interesting about that document is that it kind of builds into what happened with the Venetian. So what's interesting is it kind of leads into then this interesting document. I never had the impression that Webster Tarpley is anything more of an economist, but instead he's a fantastic historian, especially on the Reformation and Counter-Reformation. Since Scotto brings it up, I'm going to try to quickly sum it up to see where a lot of these philosophies developed. So it kind of leads into some of the secret societies that build out into then what happened during the Enlightenment and the late Renaissance, essentially.
Well, because when John brings up the Protestant Reformation and Luther, when he talks about Calvin, when we talk about Ignatius Loyola and the Jesuits, I needed to do more research on my own. It's not, you don't automatically get this just from asking the questions and listening to John give the answers. I have a responsibility, not only for my own learning, but for what we're doing as far as the production, to go out and truly try to understand this, you know, these ideas through the best resources. So my understanding was greatly enhanced a couple years ago when I read this document authored by Webster Tarpley in 1992. What's the title of it, Tony?
The Role of the Venetian Oligarchy in Reformation, Counter-Reformation, Enlightenment, and the 30 Years' War.
So I always just refer to it as the Venetian Black Nobility document, because the Venetian Black Nobility were this group of merchants and bankers and, dare I say, pirates who had a very strong capital base and basically were insulated or independent of the Vatican Holy Roman Empire system, in particular because they operated out of Venice because of their techniques, because of their world travel and the knowledge
trade,
and their ability to get these documents that came back with the Templars, translate them, because otherwise the church would have just banned all these things. So it was a group that rivaled power to the traditional state and establishment at that time. And this document did a great job, in my opinion, that I had Tony read through it and research it and verify it to make sure that what I had read years ago and had placed in a high esteem in my mind still actually reflected. And what we learned from going through that, as juxtaposed to what John is teaching us through these hours, is truly remarkable, because you're finding all the proof and evidence that he was looking for once and upon a time, trying to find his way, or Sutton was trying to do once upon a time, finding his way through these things. And once you understand it and can put it into a brain model and click all these connections and see how it all moves through time, it gives you self-confidence and self-esteem, because now you're actually understanding it, possibly not only for the first time for yourself, but possibly for the first time in history, because of the technology we can use to connect this information and to share it with others.
Yeah, I mean, so with that, it goes back to the point that Venice was an isolated state. In fact, you know, they mastered what we could call oligarchism, which essentially is, you know, is as old as civilization itself. And, you know, they had interest rates such as 20%, as high as 20%, that they would go in, dominate countries by banking and so forth and so on. So what's interesting is they were also, By chance, the Venetians were the first in Western Europe to read Aristotle directly in the Greek text, first at the School of Rialto, where patricians lectured on Aristotle, and then in 1400, then the University of Padova. And so it all kind of centers around this character named Gasparo Contarini. And
I would get to the point and say that this guy Contarini and his friends, whether it be the Medici bankers or any of these other Venetian black nobility bankers, funded Ignatius Loyola and the Counter-Reformation because they had already funded Martin Luther and the Reformation. So they're funding both sides, giving ideas to both sides. It's possible, if not likely, that Martin Luther was an initiate of the Rosicrucian Society.
Right, yeah, there's connections with the Rosicrucian, the Francesco Zorzi and the Venetian Zorzi group of people that, you know, influenced people such as Robert Fludd and John Dee and Bacon, Hume, so forth and so on. So you can see how these irrational philosophies kind of develop up, you know, throughout time. And what essentially they did, ironically, is they denied the human soul, which I know last podcast Gatto mentioned about how they denied the belief in the human soul insofar as they kind of corrupted the understanding of what we call universals or universal essences in logic. That's something has its own nature by essence. They're red to redness, just basic universal qualities that pertain to certain concepts. So what's interesting is that they deny that exists and said that there's no empirical evidence that we could ever know of a soul that exists because we're always impregnated by sense perception. And so they denied all of this and tried to pretty much substantiate this philosophy throughout, first in the Reformation. Then Contarini again helped fund and protect Loyola and the Counter-Reformation. And then it just built out with up until the 30 Years' War, with characters such as Paolo Sarpi, Hume, I think Hobbes. You have the whole issue with, you have Thomas Cromwell in there and King Henry VIII with that whole, where that whole split took place. Interesting enough, Thomas Cromwell, I believe his, I don't know if it's his son, Oliver Cromwell, Freemason, that has connections to Puritanism. So you have all these interesting little branches in the Counter-Reformation, the spiritually a group that centered around essentially Calvin's Institute on the, I think it's Institute on the Christian religion, something of that nature. And so they centered around that text. So you can see how all these different texts are perpetuating throughout time that Gatto gives reference to. And you can essentially the Venetians used both sides to gain their own advantage, both monetarily and in land as well. So it's a very extensive document. So it takes
It's 20 pages, but it's very dense, and it takes it took Tony 2 weeks to map it all out in the brain and to get all the links and whatnot together. So that can be a whole other podcast on its own.
Right.
But in terms of trying to understand what John is describing and the answers he's giving to the questions I'm asking at this point in the interview, it's all about how did this philosophy of justified sinning originate, develop over time, become so powerful, and how did we become so helpless to defend ourselves against it? And it's at this point in history where in 1773, the Vatican, which pretty much sanctioned and created the Jesuits, now bans the Jesuits. And the Jesuit orders are being expelled and extinguished, but you can't really enforce that. So now they have to go underground. They take on other characteristics and other names. And up 3 years later pops this professor, Adam Weishaupt, in the electorate of Bavaria in what we know today as Germany. And I asked John about Weishaupt and what possible role could this character have as juxtaposed to the history of our public education system. John replies with the statement that it would take too many allusions, too many historical references that the common person who's been through public schooling doesn't have to understand this. It takes too many of these common references to history to understand this, and since most people don't have this history in their head, he's not even going to address it directly. He's going to tell you about standardized testing, and you ask the question, why would they do standardized testing if it's not an indicator of education, right? Then that leads you into, it's a slave system, it's a control system, it's not an education system, which leads you to who's in charge of that, and it brings you to the same point, but he just wants you to go around the corner and find it yourself. And I feel obligated to offer up some of the copious artifacts and references that are some of the most interesting history that one could study about America and the origins of this country and finding out who we are, how we got here, why things are this way, why they continue to be this way until we learn about these documents and treat them for the reality that they are and learn our way forward. So I have a what might be called a semi-comprehensive list of references here. And feel free to interject if you have any comments on these. First, I'd like to start out with the Oxford English Dictionary entry for the Illuminati. A name assumed or applied by various societies or sects because of their claim to special enlightenment in religious or later intellectual matters. Applied to a Spanish sect of heretics which existed in the 16th century under the name Alumbrados or Enlightened. And then entry 3 in the Oxford English Dictionary, the name of a celebrated secret society founded at Ingolstadt in Bavaria in 1776 by Professor Adam Weishaupt, holding deistic and republican principles and having an organization akin to Freemasonry, hence applied to other thinkers regarded as aesthetic or free thinking. And then it cites John Robison's 1797 book, Proofs of a Conspiracy. It then cites the letters of George Washington. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting that the Oxford English Dictionary cites these letters from George Washington. So what did I want to do? I wanted to look them up. And then I found this article. George Washington acknowledged the doctrines of the Illuminati were spreading in the United States. If you ever doubt the existence of the Illuminati order, there are archives from George Washington himself, which proves that they not only exist, but were intensively active in America. Though George Washington, as a Freemason, denied participation of Freemasonry as a whole in the Illuminati order, which was known to recruit members from inside Freemasonry, he acknowledged that their presence in America was not unknown to him. On the contrary, in his own word, quote, "It was not my intention to doubt that the doctrines of the Illuminati and the principles of Jacobinism had not spread in the United States. On the contrary, no one is more truly satisfied of this fact than I am," end quote. You can search on the Library of Congress yourself for the word Illuminati. There's a link in the notes to do so. Below are screen copies of the full transcript of George Washington's letters. So I have a ton more notes on that, but that was the Oxford entry and what it led me to, which was finding these letters of George Washington on the Library of Congress. Those are pretty good references. There's also the 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition. This is pre-censorship for mass distribution, entry on Illuminati. There's also the Catholic Encyclopedia, entry for Illuminati. These are all in the notes. There is the Estonian Wikipedia, entry for Illuminati, which cites kindergarten as a novice initiative level of the Illuminati. I'm going to skip over about 10 other sources, but we'll list them in the notes. And then we'll go to Thomas Jefferson's letters. The writings of Thomas Jefferson, Volume 7, 1795 to 1801, pages 419 to 421. And I believe Kevin read that quote into the record on the last episode of this podcast. So we will go ahead and skip on to mentioning John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry, 1832. And this was a consequence of the Morgan Affair of 1826, where they killed Captain William Morgan. What I would just say to make the rest of the Illuminati documentation short and sweet, if you're really interested, you should click on the links, click into the primary sources, explore them for yourself, and really take a look at the things that they are not teaching in public school, which helped make so much sense out of the world once you understand that the thing which appears to you to be broken is actually designed that way on purpose. Last but not least, we talked about hemp. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all these characters who were founding fathers, self-reliant, were also understanding and very vocal about the value of hemp.
And for anyone interested in learning more, I would suggest Jack Herer's The Emperor Wears No Clothes, the authoritative historical record of cannabis and the conspiracy against marijuana, wherein right in chapter one, he defines cannabis, hemp, marijuana, etc., and almost takes a trivium-like approach to giving you all of the historical references, etc. And the book itself is very comprehensive. But in the first chapter under American historical notes, it reads, in 1916, America's first marijuana law was enacted at Jamestown Colony, Virginia, quote, ordering all farmers to make trial of or grow Indian hemp seed. More mandatory must-grow hemp cultivation laws were enacted in Massachusetts in 1631 in Connecticut in 1632, and in the Chesapeake colonies into the mid-1700s. Even in England, the much sought-after prize of full British citizenship was bestowed by a decree of the crown on foreigners who could grow cannabis, and fines were often levied against those who refused. Cannabis hemp was legal tender, or money, in most of the Americas from 1631 until the early 1800s. Why? To encourage American farmers to grow more. You could pay your taxes with cannabis hemp throughout America for over 200 years. Reading further down, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson grew cannabis on their plantations. Jefferson, while envoy to France, went to great expense and even considerable risk to himself and his secret agents to procure particularly good hemp seeds smuggled illegally into Turkey from China. The Chinese mandarins, or political rulers, so valued their hemp seed that they made its exportation a capital offense.
That begs the question, how did hemp come to be prohibited in our society? What connection would propaganda, publication, poor education have on someone like William Randolph Hearst and his ability to make something like hemp, which is useful, into a dirty word that no one's supposed to bring up anymore at the dinner table, right? And this is the subtext of Citizen Kane or RKO 281 or the battle over Citizen Kane. This is what Hearst was really doing but couldn't be pointed out directly. And I think it's his real legacy is getting hemp prohibited and getting our forests decapitated by the whole process of our dependence on wood pulp paper because of the prohibition of the panacea for the situation.
I would add that Benjamin Franklin started one of America's first paper mills with cannabis. And in chapter 4 of Harrer's book, under the section, A Conspiracy to Wipe Out the Natural Competition, quote, in the mid-1930s, when the new mechanical hemp fiber stripping machines and machines to conserve hemp's high cellulose pulp finally became state-of-the-art, available and affordable, the enormous timber acreage and businesses of the Hearst Paper Manufacturing Division, Kimberly-Clark, USA, and virtually all other timber, paper, and large newspaper holding companies stood to lose billions of dollars and perhaps even go bankrupt. Coincidentally, in 1937, DuPont had just patented processes for making plastics from oil and coal, as well as a new sulfate-sulfite process for making paper from wood pulp. According to DuPont's own corporate records and historians, quote, these processes accounted for over 80% of all the company's railroad car loadings over the next 60 years into the 1990s. So if hemp had not been made illegal, 80%...
In the 1890s.
Well, the book reads into the 1990s, but...
I would note that DuPont is one of those powder interests that Congressman Oscar Calloway talks about when he says that J.P. Morgan had bought off. J.P. Morgan, the powder interests, that's DuPont. They make black powder for war. They make ammunition. They have a lot to gain by going on a petroleum standard. They would partner up with Rockefeller, who has a petroleum industry. They would figure out how to make plastic, while at the same time over here, Henry Ford had just figured out how to make plastic from hemp. And he was extremely competitive with these other forces, and they went to battle that was never publicized, but that's
right.
More history
because
and a different history.
And Henry Ford...
Sorry, go ahead, Jan.
Oh, I was just going to say, and Henry Ford actually had started making a model of car out of hemp, and what happened was, as far as I recall, and, you know, thanks for reading Jack Harrer's book. I was a good friend of his for 18 years. But that what they did was they put gas lines in the cars. DuPont basically helped to start the General Motors Corporation that put gas lines in the cars that would rot if anything other than petrol or gasoline was run through them.
Because the first engines were running on alcohol that could be produced by farmers on a farm by a still, just like you produce drinking alcohol. They could fuel their own vehicle.
Exactly.
And everyone could be autonomous.
And not only that, but they could power their diesel engines on vegetable oil pressed out of the hemp seed that they were getting directly off the farm as well.
You know, it's interesting to kind of, you know, juxtapose this to how God has been presenting all this information is that how quickly and how powerful media has been used to control us, because really what we're seeing here is all these different characters behind the scenes when it comes to Hearst, for example, controlling so much of the newspaper industry in the day, being able to spin such a story when there's such an unbelievable, substantial history behind hemp, for example, and being able to spin this story along with help from Rockefeller and the whole prohibition, what happened with alcohol, that also kind of ties in with some of the effects that went on during that time as well. Then after World War II, when they banned it again, even though they needed it during World War II, right, to make ropes and all these different mechanisms for the army. So when we look at it in perspective, it's just interesting the power that media has and the influence it has, because we're just making reference to Gordon Wasson and Henry Luce and C.D. Jackson, all these people that really worked in media so heavily.
And well, in psychological warfare, what you're seeing is it's the conditioning and schooling for adults, for people who have graduated through the public school system. After you get out, your continued education is provided through the psychological warfare that is Time Life, People, all these different places, AOL, what have you. And so to bring it back, what you see is a pattern that could only precipitate if public schooling had been corrupted first. Then you can be subject to all this psychological warfare. But if you had been trained in school how to intellectually defend yourself, how to ask questions and attain valid answers that check out with objective reality, then you would not be defenseless and you would not be subject to the propaganda and the psychological warfare. What you see today is that adults are totally bought into the reactionary, emotion-driven psychological warfare culture, and that is a checklist at the bottom of the page where they're like, how do we know this works? Well, let's put more stupid shit out there and see if no one protests or no one does anything effective against it, and people just lap it up, whether it's the content on TV, the content in your newspapers, the content on your favorite internet site that's run by a major corporation. Any of these things are all serving the same purpose, and it has nothing to do with your ability to survive and thrive in this world. Hey, Kev, since you spent a good bit of hour four before we rolled the tapes and after the tape ran out speaking with John, and that's not necessarily it's part of this hour but not in this interview directly, do you want to talk a bit about Bionomics and then feather in the sources that you found on the Bavarian Illuminati and its influence on education?
Sure. We were getting ready for day two, and I gave Gatto some books to check out. One of them was The Molecular Vision of Life by Lily Pukay, who was a history of biological systems. And she wrote a book that was basically exposing how the Rockefeller Foundation, using the new science of molecular biology as a directed consensus mechanism of the scientific and business elite with the goals of eugenics and social control. And it was based on this new science of man agenda and the social control principles of Edward Allsworth Ross, and also the Prediction and Control book by John B. Watson. And it's interesting that this book comes out at the same time that the first Rockefeller Foundation was instituted in 1913. The science of man agenda being advanced by the Rockefeller Foundation was centered around biology and psychology. They said that social sciences should be seen as validated through the evidences of social control. This changing of language that Gatto talks about is very prevalent throughout this book, because they were trying to disguise the eugenics movement in a more fashionable light. And Linus Pauling, who was one of the head scientists being funded in this molecular biology project, was in favor of Union Now, which we've talked about, the Clarence Strait, and the agenda being advanced by the Rhodes-Milner Roundtable Group. He was also an advocate of population control and eugenics as well. Gatto had heard of this book, and he went into a questionnaire with me on if I had ever heard of Bionomics, and brought up Elwood P. Cubberley and the Educational Trust, who was affiliated with the Teachers College at Columbia University. And Cubberley essentially viewed education as social engineering, and he studied under Thorndike, and that's a link to Wilhelm Wundt via Cattell, the founder of psychometrics. I've got a book here that Gatto mentioned called Managers of Virtue, and I'd like to read passages into the record that I think are very relevant. By invoking the state, political leaders hastened the time when a member of the later Educational Trust, Elwood P. Cubberley, in 1909 could say that each year the child is becoming to belong more to the state and less to the parent. The reformers of man's generation had believed that they had been the chosen agents of a provincial deity. The administrative progressives were certain that they possessed the instruments of scientific progress that would enable them to shape society toward even nobler ends. By a selective interpretation of a history of the public school, the educators of the progressive era were able to create a sense of inspiring tradition for the new generation of full-time professional leaders. They were building, they thought, on the foundation laid by the generation of Horace Mann. Indeed, they did share many of the same concerns with the Victorian school promoters, especially their interest in moral and civic training, their passion for efficiency and their earnestness, their desire to combine new bureaucratic techniques with traditional ideals and character. But there were significant differences in the outlooks and strategies of the later educational leaders. The rhetoric of reform shifted slowly from a revivalist Protestant Republican ideology to the language and science of business efficiency. Instead of trying to mobilize local citizens to act, the 20th century managers sought to take schools out of politics and to shift decision-making upward and inward in hierarchical systems of management. Believing that the basic structure of society was just and progressive, the new leaders thought they knew how to bring a smoothly running, socially efficient, stable social order in which education was a major form of human engineering. Society would control its own evolution through schooling. Professional management would replace politics, and science would replace religion and custom as a source of authority, and experts would adapt education to the transformed conditions of modern corporate life. One day in this dream, political conflict over education would become as futile and unnecessary as witch trials. The experts would run everything to everyone's benefit. This would be their own version of a millennial future. The idea of a society planned by experts and run by scientific managers rested on assumptions not only on how to govern, but also who should govern. It was a conception of leadership designed to consolidate power in large and centralized organizations, whether steel mills, large department stores, or city school systems. The process of concentrating decision-making power and delegating it to a manager in public education is most apparent in the campaign of the administrative progressives to alter the governance of urban education. There, the new advocates of the professional management and their allies among the elite business and professional groups waged political battles to destroy the old word-based and lay management schools and replace it with a new corporate model of decision-making. Within the school system, Cubberly had an intensely hierarchical view of leadership, seeing the superintendency as the central office in the school system, up to which and down which authority, direction, and inspiration would flow. To increase social efficiency, Cubberly argued that schools should give up exceedingly democratic ideas that all are equal and that our society is devoid of classes, as few critics have in large part done, and to begin a specialization of effort along many new lines in an attempt to adapt school to the needs of the many classes in the city life, at the same time that it differentiates the curriculum to meet the different destinies of these classes. The school must create loyalty in existing political economy. The school curriculum is effective only insofar as it is closely related to the needs and problems of our social, civic, and industrial life. And I'm going to illustrate how this all ties back in with the Bavarian Illuminati shortly, because there are some parallels here that are unmistakable. Okay, last quote. Conceptions of research and new organizational forms borrowed from business did influence those who wished to engineer public education into a pedagogical conglomerate parallel to the economic sector. But the borrowing went the other way, too, from education to business. Industrial psychologists learned from school experts how to use their ability and aptitude tests. So what I'm trying to illustrate here is that with Managers of Virtue that he brought up in response to the molecular biology book that he had not read but he had heard of, there is a very obvious notion of social control and the adjustment function and how to maintain a balance that is profitable to a status quo that brings those profits. On the Bavarian Illuminati, John Taylor Gatto says that there's too many illusions. Richard already went into that, how it would take – he felt like it would take explaining things to in a much broader manner.
Can you describe the difference between illusion and allusion, Kevin?
Sure. An allusion or an allusion would be if I were to allude to the fact that I have something in my pocket at this moment rather than showing you.
According to a quick web search, the definition of allusion or allusion is an expression designed to call something to mind without mentioning it explicitly, an indirect or passing reference.
And so while John didn't want to present his allusions or indirect references to this content, we are specifically armed with the research data, primary and secondary artifacts to fully flesh out in the short period of time and in the body of the notes for this episode that which public schools cannot afford to teach you.
I have quite a bit here to go into on the Illuminati. I don't know if you wanted to do it in a discussion format, but I do have quite a few notes. Some of it is mentioned with the –
Well, let's hit the main points, and then we can put the rest in the notes for this episode.
Okay. And I would point people to – and I am greatly indebted to a couple books that have came out recently over the last few years, one of which is Perfectibilist by Terry Mollinson, and another is...
You gave him Perfectibilist at the end of the interview, right, Kev?
Yes, I did. But I just want to make sure to give these guys props, because one of the books that I'm about to send reference out on the airwaves to, he's not even published yet, but he's got it on the internet. Yeah, I am indebted to the Illuminati Manifesto of World Revolution, 1792 by Nicholas Bonneville, translated and introduced by Marco De Lucchietti, as well as the Perfectibilist book by Terry Mollinson and many other resources online. But I found a quote here from Adam Weishaupt that I believe John Robison pulled, and it says, "Never lose sight of military schools, of academies and printing presses, libraries, cathedral chapters, or any public establishments that can influence education or government. Let our regents perpetually attend to the various means and form plans for making us masters of all these establishments. The prefect will spare no plans to gain possession of the schools which lie within his district, and also of their teachers. He will find means of placing them under the tuition of the members of our order, for this is the true method of infusing our principles and training our young men." So the evidence is out there that the Bavarian Illuminati...
Well, let's define evidence. Is that some quote that you just found on the internet, or can you cite some sort of primary source from which that is pulled so we know that Adam Weishaupt actually wrote about that?
Is it the Illuminati strategies indoctrination, how final aim was progressively revealed? Trying to think where...
That's the Mellinson document from 2005, the exegesis of actual sources and artifacts.
Yeah, that one's the other one. On Marco Lucchetti's website, if I'm correct. And but I'm not sure, because there were some of the free documentation that was available from his website that you pointed me to, Kevin. Is right. That where it came from? Yeah. And then it was the PDFs. I believe, if I read it correctly from his website, I believe they were supposed to be direct translations that were available.
Of those four Illuminati documents?
Right.
Okay, so those are posted in the notes, the original copies that come from Harvard and Stanford and well-known universities who have these things on file.
It's interesting how these documents expose more of the core inner doctrine of the philosophy, because it's kind of hard searching through exactly what Weishaupt and all these other characters were expounding as far as their philosophic beliefs and discourse.
Okay, I'm going to read that again, and then I'm going to read the source into it. This is from Influence Over Schools. It's from Chapter 7C of an unpublished book by Marco De Lucchietti, which he has so kindly made available for researchers online. And it states that the Illuminati sought to influence in the schools. Weishaupt, the founder of the Illuminati, was himself a college professor. He had firsthand experience on how to use schools as both recruiting grounds and as a center to propagate his ideas. He said it was also necessary to gain the common people to our order. The great means to this end is the influence in the schools. Weishaupt elsewhere directed his members that we must acquire the direction of education and of church management and of the professional chair and of the pulpit. He also instructed his leadership never lose sight of the military schools and of the academies, the printing presses, the libraries, cathedral chapters, or any other public establishments that can influence education or government. Let our regents perpetually attend to the various means and form plans for making us masters of all of our establishments. The prefect will spare no pains to gain possession of the schools which lie within his district, and also of their teachers. He will find means of placing them under the tuition of members of our order, for this is the true method of infusing our principles and our training of our young men. And that is sourced from Clifford's Application of Burrell's Memoirs, Supra Preliminary Observations, which will be in the notes.
And that's talking about Abbey Burrell, who was a part of a Christian unit that had identified this conspiracy, and then it's juxtaposed to Robison's 1797 book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, which was cited in the Oxford English Dictionary entry that we mentioned when we began.
There is another reference from Illuminati Aims from Marco De Lucchietti, and it's entitled Taking Education of Children Away from Parents. In 1806 to 1808, Johann Fichte gave us further insight into the Illuminist goal to create a new man in the new order. Fichte advocated taking away children from parents, whether one parent
hey,
or
Kev,
both.
Yes. Just read it again and mention just that's the origin of the Prussian education system, and call him Fichte.
I actually got on YouTube and Googled German people saying his name and laughing at Americans.
Yeah.
So I was trying to say it correctly, but...
Okay, well, then you can mention that, too, that I had it right and John had it wrong. That'd be good.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have... No, it's Fichte.
Well, you know, William Durant calls him Ficta as well.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference. I had it called to my attention by my brother and kind of laughed at me, so I was trying to get it right. So, okay, so in 1806 to 1808, Johann Ficta, or Fichte, gave us further insight into this luminous goal to create a new man in the new order. Ficta advocated taking away children from parents, whether one parent or both be unwilling. This will begin from a very early young age. It will accomplish two things. First, by removing Christianity from the curriculum for such extended periods of time, the Christian religion would finally be banished. Ficta wrote, such a religion was obviously a servant of selfishness. Such shall indeed be born to the grave along with the past age. Second, as a result, this would lead to a new human race. There's a common thread here of a new human race, a new science of man, a new man. This means...
Well, what happens after 60 or 70 years of Prussian education system? Don't they get the Nazis? National socialism?
Right. And they're well aware that this ideology was exported to the United States, and I've seen other accounts where they say that the education system in the United States is just as pure as the Germanic bloodlines, and it's very, very interesting. This means that selfishness and individuality will cease as notions of inequality disappearing in this little state. Ficta concludes that the virtuous result for each member of this kinder state, everyone should know that he is absolutely indebted to the community and should eat or starve along with the community. Then, as a result of this experience, isolated from the corruption of a dying past, it is then utterly impossible for the pupil not to desire the new order of things and will thereafter use all of his strengths to promote it when freed from the guidance of education. In sum, numerous sources, direct testimony, quotes from the teachings revealed in the Illuminati papers, and direct statements of Illuminati members, leaders, collaborators, and writers, each demonstrate that the Illuminati's utopian plan included separating children at birth from their parents, having them raised by enlightened members of the community in one large group, and abolish the family. In this manner, as Ficta most bluntly explained, one could rid religious ideas from young people and prevent contamination of such ideas from adults.
Well, it sounds like he's either plagiarizing from Plato's Republic or predicting Huxley's Brave New World.
And it's also coming from Rousseau as well, from what I found. And such communal education would also remove any model to youth of a traditional female-male monogamous marriage relationship. The children of such a community would only know communal values.
Are you guys seeing the overlap here at all of the New Age and the New Age movement, the New World Order? We're all as one, one people, the global community, all of these ideas. This is all tied into this.
Yeah,
it's the same exact concept. And what they're doing is, you know, they're promoting this whole global community. Get rid of your local sovereignty, your individualism, this whole zeitgeist movement. To, you know, have the machines take over, the ultimate authority of the machines and the so-called ecosystem, as Adam Curtis has laid out in his documentary, The All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. And all of these things are geared towards that whole global mentality and Plato's Republic and Huxley's Brave New World, which is what the zeitgeist movement is. And getting everyone to relinquish everything and hand themselves over, open arms, you know, reach up and we're all evolving. Let's evolve together straight into the New World Order.
Yeah, I do think there's a lot of common threads in between all of these things that we're discussing here. And I think that whether or not they're direct continuations of the Illuminati per se, there are a lot of people going around irresponsibly today using the word Illuminati to describe pretty much anything that they feel in disagreement with. And I think that does a disservice to kind of getting to the lineages of these actual ideologies and seeing how they spread over time.
Well, as opposed to the Dan Brown Sony Pictures version.
Well, is that an intentional conflagration of this information to confuse people, though, that they can't figure it out? You know, so we're... You know, so people that have their grammar, logic, and rhetoric in the right order, as the Masons and everyone else teach, can go back through and figure out how they did this stuff.
Well, it's ironic because they did it by taking over, you know, institutions from the inside, because they use religion as a mask, they use politics as a mask, they use whatever they, secret societies as a mask, whatever they could to perpetuate this utopian ideal that, you know, Gatto spent this time building out, essentially.
Figuring out and verifying and
showing the connections, which would be the logic, right? The why. He presented all this general grammar that people, you know, all these independent pieces of history that people conveniently either left out or just didn't didn't, you know, want to make those connections, even though they're right there. So it's ironic that it's just built out to exactly, you know, with the whole singularity, New Age movement, the technocracy, the transhumanist movement, and how we see, again, these parallels of utopian control.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back a step, Tony, because you're going that direction. And then I think it was you that mentioned Esalen earlier, right? Well, Terrence McKenna and the whole 2012 movement and Time Wave Zero and all of that stuff comes, you know, Esalen promoted that material as well. But Esalen, the Tavistock Institute, and all of the connections that Kevin has found.
Goes back to MK Ultra and psychological warfare through magazines and stuff. So that's full circle. Go ahead, Kev.
Yeah, and you really can't, of course, we can't really trust Adam Weishaupt, but he's famous for, in his own writings, describing how he could play one group against another. They would recruit people in who may or may not have been Christians, or may or may not have been deists, or may not have been Rosicrucian, or could have been even past Jesuits that are in disguise. Who knows? I mean, his do as thou wilt ideology translated into turning Christianity into a function that he could use. For some people, they would represent that it was about Jesus Christ at the center of the order. For others, it was about something completely different. And it was really just about using people.
So they had a philosophy of justified sinning? Is that what you're saying? We're sniffing that out?
Right. They had it. And with what took place in Germany at that time, or in Bavaria, rather, they had lodges called the Strict Observance Lodge, which from my research shows that it is an offshoot of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. But these lodges were not of the same York Rite lineage, and they had their own degree system. And what the Illuminati wanted to do was come in to install a fourth degree on top of the traditional 3 degrees that this German branch of Freemasonry had adopted. And the Bavarian elects, after the horseback rider was struck by lightning and all of the papers were exposed, Carl Theodor expelled the secret societies, and Adam Weishaupt had to move to a new province. And J.C. Bode and Carnegie were in charge of the order at that time. And there are writings that show that they used the Congress of Wilhelmsbad as a way to consolidate German Freemasonry, Strict Observance Lodge Freemasonry, into the French Revolution. And if you really look into it, and so much of the revisionist history, and even Carol Quigley and others have said that, no, there was no connection to the Illuminati.
Hammer time. Because the point that everyone would make on TV, these false little people that go out and tell these stories on TV, they would say that the Illuminati was banned in Bavaria by the government in 1786, and therefore it ceased to exist. But my question is, how do you enforce a ban on a secret society? And then I would note from history that George Washington's letters from 1798 say, hey, it's still going on, that it has to do with the Jacobins and the French Revolution, and that their pernicious principles have infiltrated Freemasonry, and that no one is more truly satisfied of that fact than George Washington.
And if they were banned in Bavaria, like, for example, if they were banned in Bavaria, what happened was you have the French Revolution, and the French Revolution essentially went down to that area in Bavaria. So it was only, a couple years afterwards regime was toppled. So it's interesting to note that it's they were able to foment within France the French Revolution, and then that led down to the Bavarian states down there that essentially collapsed.
You look into Fire in the Minds of Men, Rhodes Scholar Billington of the Library of Congress, and he identifies without going any further, that Alec Bonneville was one of the driving forces of the revolution in France. And what Marco De Lucchetti has done with the Illuminati Manifesto of World Revolution, republishing and translating this 1792 manifesto, is he exposes how Alec Bonneville was in direct contact and used J.C. Bode, the number two in the Bavarian Illuminati, as a publisher. And not only that, that J.C. Bode had came to France and initiated people at both the, I believe, the Amos Reunis Lodge, through history have entered.
Didn't Thomas Paine have a menage a trois with Bonneville? Publishing?
Yeah, that was, what was the name of that documentary? The Hidden Faith of the Founding Fathers, I believe. It may have had a Christian leaning, but if people want to
go and see if
those things can be hashed out, I mean, it's proven that when Bonneville came to the United States, he brought his wife, and his wife stayed with Thomas Paine and kind of acted as a secretary with his papers. And if you really want to go into it, Nicholas Bonneville had a son who was later financed by John Jacob Astor to explore the West. So, you know,
is Nicholas Bonneville different than Alec Bonneville that you just mentioned a couple moments ago?
Did I say Nicholas Bonneville? Yeah, if I said Alec Bonneville, I was wrong. I was Nicholas.
Thank you.
Nicholas.
I was going to say, does Kevin have any more Illuminati references before we make the part two? Yeah,
I totally do. Some of the illusions that we can hash out in regard to the Illuminati, I would say to look into Johann Pestalozzi. Johann Pestalozzi lived from 1746 to 1827. He's known as the father of modern educational science. I'd like to read a passage from Perfectibilist. Pestalozzi proposed a practical way of educating the masses to love God and country and to become more effective workers without threatening the elite class and wealth and power. Pestalozzi argued for a practical education for the new proletariat that was looked upon with favor by the power elite, for suggesting that, quote, the poor must be educated for poverty, for in order to enjoy the best possible state, both of the soul and of the body, it is necessary to desire and to be content with still less, unquote. Under the circumstances, it is little wonder that Fichte's call for a rejuvenation of the Prussian nation along Pestalozzian lines could be met with such electrifying and positive support by the aristocratic classes of Prussia. Here was an education which could meet the needs of the masses and the nation without threatening the class structure. Now, Johann Pestalozzi's name in the Illuminati was Alfred the Great, the allusion to educating the masses.
And how do we know the names, their code names, Kevin?
Well, these have been discovered by various historians over time.
Did the Bavarian government discover these documents and publish them at all?
Like, one of Weishaupt's helpers, I believe one of the original Areopagites, was struck by lightning, and these documents were turned over to the Bavarian elector, who published them publicly. And most of the lists that he released were of Illuminati members within the Bavarian lines, although they did get contacted from foreign provinces like the Austrian government, who were asking about possible foreign connections to Illuminati members. And I would invite people to research that out and see that Marquis de Lafayette, the aide-de-camp to George Washington, is on that list as a potential member. I think that can be verified through Marco de Lucchetti's work, as well as Mirabal. And Thomas Paine is listed. Now, curiously, one of the rubs against this particular document, even though it was discovered by chance when somebody was researching Constantinople, was that this document had Thomas Paine listed, and it said that some of these people may have been mixed in as regular Freemasons. But I'm not sure how much of a Freemason Thomas Paine was with the expose he wrote about how they were using sun worship and the Christian religion intermingled. He wrote a pretty damning expose on that that was released after his death. Now, that's for historians to decide.
Well, the point is, it's really actually, history is so much more interesting than the fiction they've taught us, A. And that, B, when the Bavarian government finds this out, they not only decide amongst themselves, they decide to publicly publish this information to warn everyone else, and they create a law that says no more Illuminati around here. They're screwing things up, which time they migrate. And these ideas migrate, and years later we have artifacts that tell us that they are embedded throughout our country in high positions of power. So that's just referencing history. Machiavelli tells you that the way to attain power is through conspiracy, and the way you maintain power is through counter-conspiracy. I believe that's in Machiavelli's Art of War.
Exactly. And I would add, with regard to the Illuminati being expelled by the Bavarian government, how do you enforce a ban on an ideology?
It's the idea at the beginning of V for Vendetta, right? That ideas never die.
Exactly.
You can't kill an idea, you can't kill an abstraction, essentially. If you think about in logic, you can't kill something that's immaterial, yet still exists as an immaterial substance or entity within our minds, or something we relate to entities. So I don't know, it's just interesting, because really what we're talking about are ideologies, philosophies, different isms that have perpetuated throughout time that really are different control mechanisms.
And unless you know about them, you can't protect yourself from them.
Exactly.
Right, because in order to protect yourself, you have to learn your way through them. You have to learn about them and learn your way past those limited perspectives.
Right.
Exactly.
And how Fichte, who believed in a pedagogy serving the state, combined with Pestalozzi, who believed in a patriarchal relationship. These connections between Fichte meeting his wife through Johann Pestalozzi's wife, and Fichte also getting his chair at the University of, I believe, Berlin, because Goethe, another Illuminati member, recommended him.
And well, wasn't Kant in there some ways?
Yeah, Kant was. He followed Kant. Now,
that's where the irrationality came in.
Other members of the Illuminati were Abel, Offsprung, Becker, Grissler, Pestalozzi, Ron, Salzman, Simon, and Trapp. These were all pedagogues in the Prussian educational system. And if you really want to get down to it, you can find reference of Hegel being the protege of Friedrich von Abel, who was an Illuminati member and teacher of Schiller. These will all be in the notes.
And a pedagogue is just a teacher. Those of you playing at home, don't be confused by the lingo used by these characters.
Right. Well, and Richard, if I'm correct, isn't the root word of pedagogy something to do with the education of slaves?
I'll leave that for people to research. There's a lot of interesting pedas that are connected.
Okay. And the Illuminati from the get-go made infiltration of the educational system a top priority. That comes from Hegel and the Hermetic tradition. I would also add that the sovereign grand commander, Albert Pike, in Morals and Dogma, said that all of the truly dogmatic religions have issued from the Kabbalah and returned to it. Everything scientific and grand in the religious dreams of the Illuminati, Jakob Berma, Swedenborg, St. Martin, and others is borrowed from the Kabbalah. All the Masonic associations owe to it their secrets and symbols. Now, when I found this, I thought that was a rather interesting quote. So I went digging on the Library of Congress website through old newspapers, which I invite other people to do because there are so many that it would take forever for anybody to go through them.
Hey, thanks, by the way, for those 1800s newspapers on the Mystic Shrine and its connection to Freemasonry and what they were writing back then. I found those to be fascinating.
Yeah, so did I. And I found another article verifying this same story in a different light from Minnesota, and I'll read a little bit from that. This is from the San Francisco Call from June 8th of 1895, and it's giving some history on the Mystic Shrine and its origin in America. It says the Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine was instituted by Muhammadian Caliph Ali, cousin German and son-in-law of Muhammad, in the year of Hijra, 25 AD, 644 at Mecca in Arabia, as an inquisition or vigilance committee to dispense justice and execute punishment upon criminals who escaped their just deserts through the tardiness of the courts, and also to promote religious toleration among cultured men of all nations. To this day, the order is one of the most highly favored among the many secret societies which abound in Oriental countries and gather about its shrine in a select few of the best educated and cultured classes. The Egyptian order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine has been independent of the Arabian, excepting the yearly presence of a deputy in Mecca, since the expedition of Ibrahim Pasha, the son of Mehmet Ali, the great Pasha of Egypt, in 1818, when the Wahhabis were conquered. They were a fanatical sect who threatened to override other power in Arabia.
Isn't that who they say the Al-Qaeda is supposed to be today? It's the Wahhabi
right.
sect?
It comes from radical Wahhabism. Yeah, I remember that being thrown out. Among the modern promoters of the shrine in Europe, of the most noted was Herr Adam Weishaupt, the Rosy Cross mystic, which there would be people that would take exception with him being a Rosy Cross mystic. But you can see that throughout his writings that he plays different organizations against each other. But this goes on to say that he was a professor of law at the University of Ingolstadt in Bavaria, who received the order in that city in May 1776 from the central body branches that had spread throughout Europe among the members, of which are recorded the names of Frederick the Great, Mirabeau, or Mirabeau, a Duke of Orleans, many members of the royal family's literary, scientific, and professional men, including the illustrious Goethe, Spinoza, Kant, Lord Bacon, and a long list of besides these. Now, that's quite a few people that John Taylor Gatto has brought up in this interview. Among the traditions of the order occurs this very significant record. In no single instance of the government in any country ventured to oppose the silent, secret workings of the nobles, although the secret agents of the governments are always present and exercise a careful surveillance in the mystic temple. The order does not advocate Mohammedanism as a sect, but inculcates the same respect to deity here in Arabia and elsewhere, and hence the secret of its profound grasp of the intellect and heart of cultured people. The public is generally familiar with the introduction to America of Billy Florence, and it goes on to discuss the jewel of the order and the Sphinx.
What year is that from? And you're talking about the Shriners who drive around in the little cars with the red fezes, right?
Yes. Yeah. It really surprised me, too. Yeah, that's who it's referring to. The San Francisco Call from June 8th of 1895. And I do have another article from the same year, I believe from a Minnesota newspaper, but I would have to pull that up for the notes.
Anything you've got that's applicable, because this is the ultimate history lesson.
And we could also discuss and have in the notes that there are members of the Illuminati who wrote letters to Ben Franklin and to John Adams, and John Adams wrote back. Fichte replaced Reinhold, is what I was looking for earlier, who was a Kantian Illuminati member. So Adam Weishaupt later on goes to write three papers against Kant, but yet he has members of his order who are Kantian Illuminati members who are holding the seats after
Weishaupt's like the Bavarian Ben Franklin. He knows how to play all those sides, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess that's leverage. One connection that I've never seen mentioned that I'd like to just get on the record is that Pestalozzi had a pupil at Yverdon School named James Pierpont Greaves from 1777 to 1842. Now, he was there for 10 years, and Pestalozzi would go on to say that he was his best pupil. Now, I found reference in The History of Philosophy of Mind, Embracing the Opinions by Robert Blakely, that Greaves was a London merchant, but falling to embarrassments, he repaired to the continent, first to Heidelberg, and then went to Switzerland, where he sojourned 10 years with Pestalozzi. Mr. Barham, in a memoir of Greaves, gives the following account of him. His mind was very ethereal, transcendental, and the mystical cast resembling that of Jacob Berma, to whom he was fervently attached. This peculiarity in intellect did not well accord the mercantile business in which the earlier years were spent, and after getting rich in commerce, he lost his fortune in imprudent speculations. On the settlement of his affairs, he went abroad and became particularly intimate with Pestalozzi and his educational system. In short, Greaves for 10 years was Pestalozzi's right-hand man. It was during this residence abroad that Greaves became profoundly initiated in German and Swiss Illuminism, and he attached himself to the aesthetic or sentimental philosophy of Baumgarten, Kant, Richter, and Schiller, who wrote so eloquently. The aesthetic philosophy, long popular in Germany, Greaves endeavored to promote in his country, and he formed the Aesthetic Society, the only one I have ever met with in Britain, in which used to meet every week in his house on Burton Street. The divine reality to which Greaves ever directed attention was the life of God and man's soul, etc., etc., etc. But J.P. Greaves goes on to found what's called Alcott House, and he founds it as a tribute to his counterpart across the sea named Bronson Alcott. And Bronson Alcott went on to become a teacher at the Temple School, instituting Pestalozzi's principles in America. And the Temple School was a Masonic temple. And Bronson Alcott had two assistants, one of which was Elizabeth Marie Peabody, as well as Horace Mann. And this all ties into the American Transcendental Movement. And I have quotes from Ralph Waldo Emerson, as well as Thoreau, praising J.P. Greaves as a sacred socialist. And J.P. Greaves had an assistant named Charles Lane, who came across the sea to work with Bronson Alcott at Fruitlands, and they established a utopian community. And this idea of utopian community is very prevalent within Illuminati writings, as well as within German idealism as a whole.
Well, in John's books, he'll tell you that Horace Mann played a key role in bringing the Prussian education system back to America. When you mentioned Swiss Illuminism, that takes us back to the first 15 minutes where I bring up the Leipzig connection, Basics in Education by Paolo Leoni. And in there, he talks about Pestalozzi and his mentor, Caspar Lavater, who was a grandmaster of the Swiss Illuminati, and how they were experimenting on homeless children and using it under the cover of education and or adoption and these sort of things, but literally experimenting so they could figure out how people work, so they could manipulate us through a soft system that doesn't seem like we're being manipulated or controlled. They're very smart, but not smart enough.
I'd also like to point out that this idea of the utopian community ties back to Wasson again and the entire psychedelic movement with the communes and that whole idea. So once again, we have another connection coming back full circle.
We can look at a lot of that as kind of a psychological warfare style situation whereby which the CIA allowed, if you follow the net and the Macy conferences, pretty much allowed Leary to go ahead and distribute LSD
sure.
at Harvard and all these different instances.
So we see psychological warfare.
So we see him kind of controlling both sides here.
Well, hold on. In B.H. Friedman's book called Tripping, a memoir, it talks about Gordon Wasson being a director of Sandoz Pharmaceuticals that invented LSD where Albert Hoffman was. Yep. And of course, Hank Alberelli's book, A Terrible Mistake, revealed that Albert Hoffman at Sandoz was in fact both CIA and French intelligence. And then
responsible for those deaths.
Right, upon
and then spring. He had ties possibly into some German secret society, if I can recall.
Leave that for the readers.
And the last important thing on the Illuminati that I would mention is that the work of Anthony Sutton in the America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, he has shown how Herbart introduced Wilhelm Wundt and Wilhelm Wundt introduced G. Stanley Hall and John Dewey. And then you had Daniel Coit Gilman and Timothy Dwight and Andrew Dixon White, who all followed in the lineage of Edward Everett.
And these guys all went to Yale. They were all skull and bones. And Anthony Sutton, who we mentioned, identified them as the Yale Troika in his chapter in the book I mentioned on Skull and Bones. And it's How the Order Controls Education. I think it's chapter 8.
And what it comes to is that Hegelian social theory plus Wundt's experimental psychology equals our modern education system.
And with that, we'll be covering minutes 15 through 30 of the Ultimate History Lesson. We'll be right back.
So if we're using wood pulp paper to make books these days, we're not only killing trees, which eat CO2 and produce oxygen to make paper towels and toilet paper and all these other things beyond books, but I noticed that a lot of the books that are printed recently, the pages are disintegrating. And when you get old books from the 1800s, 1700s that are printed on hemp paper, they're still pretty, you know, existent. We have a Johnson's Dictionary from 1848, and it's not printed on the same wood pulp acid, you know, paper that we have today. So can you comment on, they undermine education, but they're also undermining just our ability to get our hands on the books to educate ourselves, closing libraries and using types of paper that, you know, basically turn to dust.
Oh, yes. And there's a... There's been, since I've been in college in the 50s, there's been a prevailing wise guy ethic that you don't actually need to read these old books because there are plenty of abstracts, digests of these old books in existence, and that will give you the guts of the old book. Well, let's take Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. What the digests don't give you is the wealthiest, most powerful man in the world. I mean, I don't know if that confluence has ever existed after Aurelius, saying that nothing you can buy is worth having and nobody you can order around with your power is worth associating with. That's a rather acid.
So how old were you when you first met Marcus Aurelius?
I was initially in translation in sixth grade in a coal mining town in western Pennsylvania where it was offered in translation. And, of course, it's eminently readable. And then in ninth grade, there was an option of reading it in Latin or doing something else. So my mother insisted that I read it, Julius Caesar in Latin, Gallius Dominus Tuis and Partes Tres at 75, Quorum Unum in Colon Belgia. We had to memorize the early part of it. But Caesar's Gallic Wars isn't some old piece of fustian that, you know, if you're an elitist, you read to plug into the ancient world. It establishes the principle that a weaker force can whip a larger force by dividing.
And being better prepared.
Yeah. You can set the larger force against one another. And you see that in schooling, the ordinary classes are set against one another by constant meaningless testing and small inconsequential prizes being given to the people who test best and wiggle their hands in the air, so that the ordinary classes are divided for a period of 12 years through meaningless competition. I noticed when I was in basic training in the Army and was told that I was going to learn in 3 hours how to take a rifle with 57 parts of blindfold and put it back together. I knew that I could not do that. I knew I could not do that. And yet, in a room with 500 other scared young people, we all did it. And they didn't say, and he finished first. You know, the important thing is, what do we learn that's enhanced by competition? I mean, what real do we learn? It gets in the way because now your rank becomes a factor rather than the quality of what you've learned. I made these ideas clear to 13-year-olds at all times and found that after about 90 days, they became as addicted to ideas and the whys of things as I was. Whenever a new idea would emerge in the classroom, this is quite literally true, I would grab a piece of chalk and write it on the wall. I'd climb a ladder and write it on the ceiling. Inside of that first 90 days, there were hundreds of digests of ideas everywhere, on the floors when there was no room left, front, back, sides of the room. I had world maps and national maps, and I could leap up and point to the origin of the idea as we know it, or simultaneously they came. As I say, it was roughly 90 days when classes that were considered the stupidest, people who'd never eaten off a tablecloth in their life, were actually, they were hot to talk about ideas. We couldn't have that. How could we maintain the social order and the economic order if we had people who became fully alive when they were young and could get up when they're knocked down? You know, I think a lot of the problem, it's very easy to assign this completely to sinister motives, and there are certainly sinister motives at work. But I think part of it is the problem of how we would manage a society that didn't require managing. And I don't think anyone's been able to solve that problem. The early America probably did it better than anyone we have easy access to.
Because I think it's not about anarchy. Anarchy is just a void or a vacuum of government. It's about being autonomous. And if you take away the government, it doesn't automatically give people critical thinking or the self-reliance that they need and the compassionate communication that they need to work together with other people to achieve goals.
Right. So
in your explanation of how you learned the most powerful lesson of doing the impossible, you knew you couldn't do that. And after an hour or so, you had just done something that you knew you couldn't do.
I knew I couldn't do it.
You took that experience and you taught younger people that they can do that because now they have more years. You had to be at least 18 to be in the Army. Now you're teaching 13-year-olds that the things that you know you can't do, you don't really know that.
Right.
And you need to get that up here first.
Right.
So the question that I would follow up with is, in your third interview on Gnostic Media with Jan Ervin, I heard you mention these words, trivium and quadrivium, and I thought it maybe is something that was off your radar, but you spoke eloquently about it. And so where do you have familiarity with the trivium and quadrivium, and what does it mean to you?
I went to Jesuit boarding school in third grade. So I'm between the ages of 7.5 and 8.5. years old, and the curriculum, reflecting back on it, which I first began to do 15-20 years ago, the intellectual diet was not modified in any way for our tender years, and the devices of discipline and motivation that would be used in an authoritarian world were, they were not chary of using, but I do believe that their hearts were in the right place. I remember being humiliated. I told you privately about this yesterday by a Jesuit brother from St. Vincent's College, which is across the street from Xavier Academy, where I went and was beaten on a daily basis by the Ursuline nuns, sometimes for mispronouncing French there. But the brother was talking to us in the middle of the Second World War about the causes of the First World War. And he had written a list of causes on the board. I had a magnificent memory before drink intervened. And he said, could somebody face the back of the room now and tell us all the causes? And I, with my memory, I did, word for word. And he burst into a harsh kind of laughter, and he said, you fool, you believe me. He erased the board and said, these are the causes of the war. Now could you do it? And now, chastened, I did, a lot less confidently. And this time, the room exploded with his scorn. He did it again. He erased the board. He said, you will never know the causes until you embed yourself into the primary documents and see how complicated a thing this is. That changed my life. I only wish I might have had a second year there, but
before you can form your logical understanding, he said, you need to get in check with the knowledge, the actual grammar. What are the artifacts?
Yeah.
Where are these things documented? What's primary sources?
And it probably has occurred to other groups, but the intellectual part of the universal Christian religion, the Catholic Church, had a respect for scholarship. And what happens as you collect data is that it forms itself into patterns. And if you record the patterns and test them to see that they hold true, eventually that suggests behaviors. So that they created two formulae, a basic formula to which Dorothy Sayers, and I'd urge all your listeners to read her essay, The Lost Tools of Learning. She's a marvelous detective story writer, and the detective stories really aren't genre stories. They're a comedy of manners about the British upper classes. But the trivium was becoming comfortable with a pattern of thinking in which you could dispel confusion. And then the quadrivium was pushing it farther into specialized areas. One of the huge mistakes that schooling makes, even homeschooling, is to organize the agenda and the goals in terms of subject learnings, English, math, social studies, science, because those categories, while better than chaos, are so crude, they tend to mask what you're actually after. Take the universal study of the English language. What you're after is a mastery of the written language, the spoken language, and your own writing. So you've got these three divisions, and now if you're after those things, your measurement's not through memory, it's through performance, which is so much more accurate. As we spoke about a little earlier in this session, the standardized tests aren't predictive, and every first-class university knows that. You don't select people because they scored here on the SATs or whatever other tests are administered, because they end up disappointing you, and you waste people who actually,
in real life, we don't use standardized tests to make decisions, whereas you actually do use the trivium to observe, to process that information, and to make informed decisions.
Right. And while there are personal variants, so I think the fundamental thing, as every philosopher in human history has said, is know yourself. This is the fundament. Now you can take principles like trivium and quadrivium, and you can do a personal adaptation of the, you know how they will work for you.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 44. That was minutes 15 through 30 of the fourth hour of the Ultimate History Lesson. I definitely misspoke when I said that first 15 minutes were the most important. That one, the first 15 minutes took us the longest to build out the primary sources, but now that I've heard what he just talks about in minutes 15 through 30, this is where we get the answers. This is the part where we get the methodology that we can apply consistently and get ourselves out of this. After 4 hours of hearing about the problem and the history of the problem and why we didn't know about the problem, we're finally talking about the solution where we can start to get traction. And this is a good place to dig in, because when we ask the question, how could we maintain our social order if we taught our children intellectual self-defense? Well, even if we don't know that answer, let's start finding out. Let's start finding out what happens when we insulate our young people from being preyed on by all these established environmental concerns called corporations or governments or what have you, that have you signing contracts from a very young age that you don't fully have information on, and thereby, by definition, you cannot consent to. We also talked about autonomy and the idea of being autonomous, knowing how to make your own decisions, use a methodology of critical thinking to make error-free decisions using valid information, all these sorts of ideas that were prevalent in early America. In Ben Franklin's education, he was training himself with the trivium and quadrivium and Xenophon's memorable thoughts of Socrates. This is the early American attitude where it's a go and get it, go and write your own script. Otherwise, you're going to be unwittingly written into someone else's script. This was the mentality of early America that was removed by the Prussian education system. So let's talk a little bit about this thing called the trivium and quadrivium. Who was Dorothy Sayers? And why doesn't everybody naturally have a method to dispel confusion and to identify truth from lies?
What I thought was interesting about this past 15 minutes with Gatto is this theme of primary sources, making sure that you go to and look up the primary sources. And I think he alludes to in the beginning the idea that when people have this idea that you can go to encyclopedias and general summations and generalizations about what happened during a certain period, and that's good enough. Yet when you go back and read the actual primary sources, you find that's much, much different, because you end up building context around.
What is a primary source, Tony? Because I would say an encyclopedia or any of these other things are at least a secondary source. They might tell you in the footnotes about these other things that they had read.
Primary sources would be first edition artifacts of books, letters, actual evidence of artifacts found at different places, so forth and so on. So it's actually alluding to evidence that you can draw on. Essentially what it does, if you break it down to trivium, it'd be this general grammar, all these basic concepts, all these pieces of evidence. And then with logic, we can put all these pieces together.
Okay, so when Kevin refers to the letters of Benjamin Franklin or George Washington or any of these other characters in American history, or when Jan's referring to the letters of Council on Foreign Relations members to each other, these sort of things behind the scenes, these are the primary artifacts that are held in the personal archives that are libraries and little buildings all around the world where they store these artifacts, where these guys had these conversations, they wrote them down. And if you take the trouble and ask politely and go through the protocol, as Jan has done in many cases, he can tell us a little bit about how to do that. But this is how you actually get the rubber meeting the road, get traction, because this is the real history. And unfortunately, we have to teach ourselves. Fortunately, we all find ourselves together trying to do the same thing, and it's a lot easier when done in a group like this, isn't it?
Well, it's just interesting that when I, in the beginning, when I read the, you know, the Wood manuscript, essentially what most of these secret societies, their whole secret is how to use your brain, like you said, Richard, or the idea is just how to learn for yourself and how to know thyself.
When they say over and over again
behind
that that's how you take chaos and make order out of it, is by applying learning. So their mysterious order out of chaos type of thing is really about this useful tool that they've obscured from reality.
Right. So when you have a methodology, then much like Otto says, you can go back to primary sources, what we just helped illustrate for the audience out there. And then he goes into a little bit, I believe he mentioned, did he mention Julius Caesar? And yeah, and the idea of divide and conquer.
He observed that in schooling, ordinary classes are set against each other through meaningless competition in a divide and conquer strategy.
Exactly. So, I mean, a divide and conquer strategy is as old as Well, it goes back.
The conspiracy to kill Julius Caesar.
Right, exactly. And it was developed during, I think, the Carthaginian Wars, I believe, when he was at Gaul, when he was in the mountains. But either way, it was developed during that time because he didn't want to lose all his forces and realize that they, much like the Reformation, they did the same thing with the German states. They could just divide and conquer through religion. In this case, it was literally divide and conquering.
There was also some monetary system corruption in there, but that's a Rubicon we'll have to cross in a future episode.
That's a whole other podcast series. So yeah, then after the idea of divide and conquer, but then how that's built up through school, through endless forms of competition and meaningless prizes to give people this provisional self-esteem and this obvious fallacy that is employed throughout ad verecundium, which is an appeal to authority, which we're all conditioned to accept at a very young age.
They give them the illusion of learning and being prepared for life when in reality they're not preparing them for...
That's what they think they're borrowing for, right, to get the education so they can be prepared for life and thrive in life. And if people just realize that that is not at all what you are really paying for, and exactly, if you discover what you're really paying for, if you ask the questions, the illusions, I-L-L-U-S-I-O-N-S, would cease to exist.
Exactly. Very well said. So... And the last point I'd like to mention here is that he has the idea of the trivium as a three-step method that you can come to certainty, but he mentions that the quadrivium gets in more formalized areas. But in a way, the quadrivium still has a great importance in showing the patterns that are ubiquitous throughout all forms of art and science and so forth and so on. So I think it shows that integrative function that's so important about the trivium, the idea of integration, the idea of putting all these different particular pieces together and integrating them so we can come to an understanding.
Well, and that's where integrity comes from, the integration of self as you go through these lessons and learn what's really going on.
To function, to come to know thyself. Yeah, so after that, I believe that's pretty much all I have.
Well, I thought it was interesting that how he describes the Vatican, how it collected a lot of data, and then it noticed patterns, and then it could predict behavior. That's the steps of the trivium. That's grammar, logic, and rhetoric. It's knowledge, identification, and collection process. The logic is connecting all that knowledge together, and the rhetoric is, now that you have this information, what do you actually do with it? What's the end result that's actionable that you can carry out? And then you keep repeating those three steps. The problem is, if you have a useful piece of information like that, and it's held by an elite class who think that they are masters and they deny it to everyone in public schools, then you have an equation that brings about the exact result everyone is realizing today and questioning for themselves. What is so special that Dorothy Sayers has made it into the conversation with John?
Well, I think what's interesting is that Dorothy Sayers came from a different field. I mean, she was a novelist. And
she's from Oxford. She's Oxford educated.
Right. And in this speech, she was lamenting on the loss of these tools that were basically our inherent learning structure anyway. But these tools were being de-emphasized in education throughout the United States and throughout England. And this can also be connected to the Rockefeller removal of the classics from American education, where they put all of this down quite publicly in newspapers, and there was an uproar of people who thought, well, this is going to lead to a whole nother dimension of living in a different class structure. And, we see this common thread from Abraham Lincoln to the Wisconsin Agricultural Society saying that if we get rid of our agrarian practices, that we're going to be susceptible to all forms of oppression. If we fall to this city conglomerate, everybody go live absent the resources necessary to survive, which is just ridiculous, then, that's where we're going to be. And I just think that this particular portion, as Tony said, really reiterates that independent verification process, as well as the notion of wanting to be, independent and have volitional control on who you're going to participate with. And that's the integrity of it. It's not that, like, all systems are bad. It's that we blindly perpetuate nonsense without thinking. And we need this methodology of communication to free us from that. It's not that, like, this Anglo-Greco descendant methodology is the only way of doing this, but it is a perfect way of explaining it and recouping this fall that our society and the world is facing as a result of the lack of critical thinking.
Well, I think Sayers does a really great job. I mean, if you look at the notes for this episode, you can click on the PDF of the document. It's only like 15 or 17 pages long. Print it out. The first couple pages might seem a little arduous and trying to make it through there, but you'll start to get to the point, and then you'll realize why you think, why you conceive of reading and informing yourself as a hard thing to do, and it's not something, no, this is totally something that's healthy, and I trust me, if you start reading into that and you start looking and get to the end of that and don't realize what's going on, please email us and we'll help explain it to you. But it's a beautiful realization once you understand. Well, first you have to come to respect the people who have set up this system because they are deviantly brilliant in this panopticon society that they have created. However, when you look at what they're actually doing, it does nothing but disgust me and turn my stomach, so that respect goes back in a corner and I hold it in reserve because I always have to respect this opposition because they're well organized and they've been doing this for a long time. But that doesn't make it right. And they start with us as children, and they continue screwing us as adults, and it goes on, and it's going to keep going on until a group of us gets together, puts our minds together, compares notes, sits down at the table, even if it's virtual on the internet like this, and gets through these things and puts it out there so that others in the audience can figure out beyond what we've already figured out here, help us connect more dots, help us get more people involved, because these are valid facts that need to be recognized, and until we start to recognize these valid objective facts, we continue to live in a world of denial and contributing every moment of our day to something that we would never agree to if we had full information. But because there's Dancing with the Stars on, we're willing to sit here and click and vote and do these things when really, if you knew what was going on, there are so many more interesting things that you could be doing with your time that are much more fulfilling in a serious way, giving you your self-esteem, giving you satisfaction. And you can learn and communicate your way out of this. It's not an easy process. It's not an overnight process. But if you get up and keep going and moving forward, it gets done. And with that, we're going to move on to minutes 30 through 45 of fourth hour of the Ultimate History Lesson. We'll be right back.
But the course I actually followed at the beginning was to say, I know this is not good for the kids I've been hired to teach. And where will I find an unerring structure? I said, obviously it will be in the most expensive elite private boarding schools. So I made a 10-year study, although it paid off at the end of the first year, and I distilled the 12 secrets of the boarding school curriculum of power. Now, I'm talking about not private schools versus public schools at all, because most private schools follow the template that public schools laid down. I'm talking about the inner circle, 20 or so. Let me just name a few of them. I'm talking about Groton, where Franklin Delano Roosevelt emerged. I'm talking about St. Paul's, where the senator from Massachusetts who ran for president, the tall, skinny guy, John Kerry, emerged. I'm talking about Andover, where the Bush family went. I'm talking about Choate, where John F. Kennedy emerged. I'm talking about one that not one person in 10,000 has ever heard of, Episcopal in Virginia, where John McCain, the populist, give me a break, emerged. I learned about Episcopal from the sports section of a newspaper. I'm looking for the next Pittsburgh Pirate defeat, and suddenly I see a tiny item that says at the homecoming football game for Episcopal Prep School in Virginia, 25,000 alumni showed up. I said, wait. It's got to be a misprint. I mean, I can understand 25,000 people came from all over the world for a high school alumni game. So now I start to look and I discover that Episcopal, it's the naked revelation of the importance of religious tradition in upscale education. Over half of the elite boarding schools in the country and all of the inner circle ones are grounded on religion, almost all on the Anglican religion, which isn't faith-based. It was put together by committees arguing about what must have been in God's mind. but also there's a respectable number that are Quaker-based. Now, here we're talking about a tiny fraction of the population, no more than 100,000 people. It's produced in the 20th century two presidents. How is that even possible statistically? What would a bookie say the odds of this little splinter group who we all are taught are innocent and unworldly and pious? Well, so anyway, so I got the 12. So I'd like to, if possible, go through a few of these because I adapted them instantly to Harlem kids and almost immediately began to produce results. It was roughly 90 days because at first Harlem kids don't believe that anything useful to them is going to happen at school. But after about 90 days, these kids start winning competitions with the inner circle kids of the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Instead of being amazed and wondered about, I'm called in and accused of child abuse. What on earth are these people doing? You must have written that for, I said, I will confess, I corrected the spelling and the punctuation, but that steel trap set of ideas proving the case. It's not mine. I'm not up to that standard there. So I began to get hot water ever since. Let me share a few of these. We all are vaguely aware that literacy is at the heart of an intellectual inner life, but what we don't understand is that prior to the First World War, literacy commonly was divided into passive literacy, reading, and active literacy, speaking and writing. And none of us are aware that in colonial days, to teach active literacy to ordinary people was a crime. Why? Because reading, you're locked in your own head, and you still have the benefit of being able to read the boss's instructions about what to do. But if you can speak well, as our current president can, or write well, you can reach way beyond your own skull and recruit allies. That's a no-no for ordinary people. They're supposed to be so inarticulate, or their writing will look so funny with ink blots and things in it that no one treats them seriously. So strong competencies in the act of literacies are at the core of elite private boarding schools like Groton, St. Paul's, Choate, Lawrenceville, Gunnery, Hotchkiss, and each one of those schools, by the way, has some legendary tycoon as a patron, or sometimes more than one. Canton, Connecticut is J.P. Morgan's baby. So, and this is in no particular order. Insight into all institutional forms. You're supposed to know the logic, the steps that we arrived at a prison system or a library system or all the other, the military system, obviously. Third, here's a secret. Some of your listeners, watchers, viewers will be school teachers. And if you teach history or literature, you will run into a great deal of difficulty moving kids. But if you approach those subjects and share this with the kids, that what we're after here is not a good story or memorizing details from Jane Austen for the test. We're after a theory of human nature. And anyone who's written a book that lasts more than their own time has spent years closely observing people in interaction. And the trace left behind is an insight that you might spend a lifetime and never have. So that's what we're after. A theory of human nature drawn from history or philosophy or literature or law, or the greatest trove that's unexamined is theology. I used to go to auctions and there'd be boxes of religious books, 50 cents or a dollar from a century ago, and nobody wanted them at auctions. But I bought them because they were cheap, and one day I have a barn in upstate New York. I picked one up idly, and I was in the hands of an intense thinker who was drawing on all history and philosophy to create an insight into human nature there. And I said, interesting that theology is something that we don't regard at all if we're ordinary people. So a few other of the secrets of the boarding school curriculum of power. Mastery of the social forms. And I would say it didn't take more than 2 days to take kids who had never eaten off a tablecloth and get them to see that the signs they give off when there's a egg spilled on the shirt, or when they walk down the street listening to the radio, or when they're too aggressive in approaching somebody, shuts off opportunity. They're like little badges that I don't want to speak to that person. And a lot of what we consider as racial or ethnic prejudice is simply that the disguise of these social forms is unknown to the person who then is discriminated against. And I said, don't believe me. I said, I'm going to instruct you in a superficial gloss of how to approach people. And then the intellectual excuse we'll use is, I'm sending you out of school for days to gather data for statistical processing. We're going to test the local comparison with what the New York Times says the nation is thinking. And I'll teach you the elementary statistics in one class session that you need. And it's a legitimate project. But meanwhile, you don't want to approach somebody and have them jump back or say, if you don't get away from me, I'll call the police. And that's what you think will happen because of the overt racial prejudice on the liberal west side of Manhattan. But it won't happen, I guarantee. Nor did it. The transition, I won't say it was 100%, but it surely was 80%. Simply from having a gloss on these social forms.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, hour 4 of the Ultimate History Lesson, minutes 30 through 45. John speaks about the active literacies, comparing and contrasting memory versus performance. He then alludes to the trivium as a method to make informed decisions, to know thyself, or as the Greeks used to say, temet noske. He then talked about the elite private boarding school curriculum, Steps of Power, a 10-year study that he did. And basically what the difference between public schooling and the elite boarding schools is that they're teaching their kids how to succeed in life and how to manage the rest of us who are growing dependent on the system. This is the comparison and contrast of experience and performance and how to succeed in life versus memorization and dependence, which is how to become a servant of the upper elite class. These are literally forms of slavery being taught through the school system, and noting that people who are literate, as John notes, that's not enough. Literacy is actually a form of slavery until critical thinking and a methodology to discern fact from fiction is exercised by the reader. So this is where the active literacies come in. It takes what you've learned and you are able to now share that with others to help teach, to get feedback, to improve your perspective, and to teach the active literacies back in the colonial times, he notes, was a crime because you could recruit allies. You could write books, and today you can even make films and do podcasts.
Because if you're competent in the active literacies, what he means by the ability to recruit allies is the ability to clearly and effectively communicate with other people in a meaningful way.
And warn them of predators.
Well, and come together and as a result become stronger, which is the complete opposite, or which is diametrically opposed to their divide and conquer
right,
strategy.
Which is stimulus response. In this case, Gatto, and the story he portrays of what he just talked about in the last 15 minutes, the statistics from the New York Times, it's interesting that...
Well, he's actually applying the trivium to gather data to form patterns and give these kids experience where they're doing adult work better than the professionals.
Instead of reacting emotionally.
Right.
And stimulus response, instead of reacting emotionally, Gatto took it upon himself to allow the kid the time that's needed and also to help, you know, foster and engender him and mentor him in such a way that will perpetuate his understanding to go about approaching this particular topic rather than just immediately responding to it emotionally. So he went about teaching these children essentially through allowing them to leave school and make up these, you know, quote-unquote intellectual excuses and go out and experience life. But in doing so, the stories they bring back for him allowed them – he was like 120 different minds coming back and giving him all this information. But at the same time, he could help them develop their own minds and especially the active literacies to help – because just like he mentioned with the – it's all based on performance. It's not grades. It's all performance. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about, and that's what these elite private boarding schools know. And that's why they teach the grammar, logic, and rhetoric of these institutions. Like he said, how they develop
the history, the social institutions,
right.
The theories of human nature, how to manipulate others, or as we've learned, how to educate others.
Exactly.
And it's no coincidence these politicians that are coming out of the same schools. And I particularly like the quote that he used that literacy was at the heart of an intellectual inner life, and how these elite boarding schools. What he did, he undertook this study and was able to, as he said, distill these particular methodologies or ways of framing things that the private schools were using that were neglected in the public schools. And I think we've, you know, demonstrated the evidences for that lack. And he, you know, he put it in motion, you know, in his field of work. He took these ideas and this to what he called the, Spanish Harlem, I believe. And he compared this to the upper class aristocratic sons and daughters that he had taught, as well as the inner city kids, and there was no difference. And this idea that some of us are damned because of genetics or because of justified sinning, and he was establishing these patterns and then putting them into motion and making a lot of people mad because they would go and be in competitions and do better than the kids that they were spending all the money to indoctrinate. So it's very, very interesting.
It's the idea of being biologically equipped. I don't know if he mentioned that before or if that's upcoming, but either way, he mentions that we have this natural innate ability to learn and discover all these different things around us, how to take all this raw material and to develop it in a new way and to be self-sufficient and reliable.
And to share our methods.
Right.
Curiosity and a fascination with life and asking the question why. I think that what you're referring to
well,
is
volition. I think one of the big things we don't talk about is volition, how important free will is and that why comes in, you know, why, like that's so important and something so that really it's commented on the great philosophers of all time, but yet is denied essentially from our understanding and, you know, obviously public schooling.
Well, it's a function of literacy because the quality of our thoughts is reflected in the quality of words we choose to think with. And it's through that thought process that we are all making decisions. And it's through that thought process that we are, you know, choosing and making choices and having volition. And I think what it comes back to is it's not what Darwin said. It's not a genetic thing that the hope lies in the fact that we all have an immense potential, and this is what Gatto is discovering during his work experience, and that we can all learn if we're given access to objective information, but we haven't been given that before. So this is where the hope starts to spread, because we're now creating pieces of art that are the active literacies packaged up so that we can share them with people around the world, share them with our friends and family, get this information out there, and start forming our own study groups and figuring this out on our own, collecting information and connecting it together and then sharing it with others. And I think the power of literacy that we've all been given, not for the purposes of our own freedom, we can use it for that, but that's not how they trained us to use it. They trained us to think that reading is hard and that studying is hard. That, get past those myths. Use literacy as the trigger for your internal dialogue, because that's where you start asking the question why. That's what leads to strategic action, and that's what leads to a mastery of the social forms that leads to survival, as opposed to trying to manipulate people. We try to educate people, and you do that by teaching them to educate themselves on any topic, and we also do that by providing examples of how we do that for ourselves. And we're always open to constructive
criticism.
I think
that's the best theory of human nature I've heard so far.
I was just going to say that, you know, they feel justified in shaping biological evolution through education, you know, and they do it in such a way that they, you know, like they pity us because they have these evolutionary theories that they give them the hang-ups, and that, along with the Anglican theology and these Episcopalian hierarchy ideas that are entrenched in all of their educational forums, you know, he says that a lot of the things that these inner schools have in common is that they have this Episcopalian or this religious backdrop to it. So even if these people come out of that agnostic, they're still using the, you know, what he said was the, I guess, the explication of the Anglican ideas. And of course, Anglican meaning English. And he said that that whole theology was created by committee. Now, you know, why don't they tell you that growing up? You know, it's like, there are key facts that are involved in your own, you know, some of us are brought up in these religious traditions, and they don't tell you that the splinter group that came from those groups had so many issues that would have rendered irrational the tenets of the latter, you know?
And it's like Mormonism, and how if it wasn't for the banning of the Masons from the first third political party in America, the Anti-Masonic Party, which was formed with the help of John Quincy Adams, subsequent to the assassination of Captain William Morgan in 1826, that political party forced the Masons to go underground in America, much like Bavaria with the Illuminati. And subsequent to that, they created Mormonism based on Freemasonry as a religion so it could be protected under constitutional rights. So what you're describing there is that the illusions that are used by these secret societies, the useful information that they withhold from us in order to have power, that illusion created is actually also their Achilles heel if we get off our proverbial butts and do our homework, start to talk with others, start to create art through the active literacies, present it to other people, get feedback, continue to learn, and move the process forward. So we're not only hearing about the problems, but we're also hearing how this goes on, and it's a good example for people to start to use and improve upon. And with that, we'll move on to minutes 45 through 1 hour of the Ultimate History Lesson. We'll be right back.
And then this should tickle people watching this segment. Then suddenly I saw that the rules of access to the great institutions of New York City by young people, which required, let's say, at the sub-treasury building where the gold is kept down in Wall Street, one teacher for every 5 students, well, a public school class of 30 students, you're not going to muster 6 teachers. But I said to the kids, how do they know you're not a teacher? Well, we're only 13. Nobody knows that. They know it because you're chewing gum with your mouth open. They know it because you're scratching your head. They know it because you slouch. They know it because you giggle. They know it because you carry a notebook that falls on the ground every few minutes and paper goes everywhere. Why don't we master what a college student, who could be a student teacher, what signs they would give off? They'd carry a clipboard. They'd cock it at an arrogant angle on their hip. They would be slightly nasty in taking attendance every few minutes or saying, when your mother hears about this, Jack. You know, I said, let's see if we can pick 5 people out of this class and penetrate security at the sub-treasury building, at the mayor's office, anywhere. We were never caught. Not once. Now, the Bronx Zoo says one for every 15 kids. But how are you going to even get two teachers to take kids to the Bronx Zoo there? Well, it's easy if the kids can shift from being 13 to being arrogant college student teachers. Never caught in 8 years of doing this.
Well, that's real self-esteem because real confidence from experience, and to be able to go into Columbia, sit in the back of a class, and see what college is like before you have to go to college takes away a lot of anxiety.
Now, I don't know why you said that, but we were only 20 blocks from Columbia, and I have a degree from Columbia, so I understood that the law school classes are the 300 people in these banks of seats, and the only way, no one takes attendance there. Your grades on the tests are evidence of whether you've been attending or not. But if you sit there slouch and pulling gum out of your mouth, yeah, someone will say, who are you? Never caught once. So our age, this artificial extension of childhood that we talked about at the beginning of this this particular session, is a secret of crowd control where people become their own prisoners by adopting the cultural signs that they're immature or they're not of our group, and simply by seeing these things as languages. There isn't one English language. You know, there are 10 that are modified according to the, you know, and someone like Obama, how, I'm not sure, they understand this and they can shift effortlessly from one idiom to another. And I would say that to the kids. I would say, look, here's why you're reading English poetry. Now, there are a lot of reasons, but here's why we're doing it. You're going to find that the ordinary unit of meaning in the English language is 3 hard stresses long, or sometimes 4, but often it's 2, 3, or 4. But as you enter the realm of intellect and you have more to say or more nuances to say, you need larger units of meaning. 5, that's iambic pentameter. Even 6, that's hexameters. There, the Greeks used 7 septameters, and I want you to feel that, and you'll feel it by reading and memorizing some of this poetry. You'll have the models built into your head to shift back and forth according to your audience there. Shakespeare, to the ignorant, writes iambic pentameter lines. And one of the reasons you don't want to even look at Shakespeare is all the lines seem to be pretty much the same length. But I'm going to teach you something that he knew 4 centuries ago. It looks like they're all the same length, but there's a breath pause in this speech after 2 hard beats. The next breath pause is 12 before you've delivered your meaning. 3, 4. There's this inner jazz at work underneath this regular pattern. You can learn to do that. Once someone exposes the secret to you, that's half the game. And the other half of the game is simply building the models into yourself so you don't have to think, now here. And yet we used an exercise that if I tell you immediately turned horribly dull writers into at least modestly interesting writers, and it's totally mathematical. I said, it'll take you a while to incorporate what I just said. So what I'm going to ask you to do is write 1 to 20 on 20 pieces of paper. put them in some sort of container and draw them out at random and then list what you've drawn out at random on a, and I said, now you're going home, not for homework, but to learn this massive skill, and you're going to write a paper on X subject, and if one is the first number that came out, the first sentence will be one word long, one beat long. And if the second one's 20, it'll be 20 long. Immediately, these horrible, remember, I had to read 120 of these things at a time. And one of the reasons they were horrible is they were all, everyone had either a 3 or a 4 unit or a mixture in there. Now they had the kind of jazz that readers aren't completely conscious of, but they record as something interesting about, even when he's writing about a milk separator. And you as a filmmaker, remember Eisenstein's film of the peasants watching milk being separated on a Russian farm in the 1920s. Why is it so awfully interesting? Because he understood things that the eye is looking at the movement of light around the screen. It's looking at entrances and exits. 13-year-old kids from Harlem can master these secrets just as well as 25-year-old Harvard students can. And then they become preternaturally sophisticated. What on earth? How do you know these things? Because they're our birthright. We're biologically equipped to learn this way. Unless somebody sticks their oar in and intervenes and says, read Jack London and memorize.
That's a school system. We've all heard about the hardware. What's going on with this camera?
Okay, I just need you to, for a minute, no, you could just reframe this camera because I think something happened.
No, when I came in, the camera was moved. I guess someone was monitoring on it or something. Or,
Either way, I just want you to make sure that you focus.
I think, and I won't be as windy and the rest, but I think that everyone will profit, and you'll see some evidences of the trivium at work here. These are the 12 secrets of the elite boarding school curriculum of power. Are we on yet, or
just 1 second? We'll be back on.
Because the next one,
that's what people don't learn in public school. Specifically, like, what is different? They're doing this, and this is about their success in life and managing the other people who don't know it.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Well, the next one will be an absolute eye-opener that took me about 5 years to tease out of the admissions procedures at Sarah Lawrence or, you know, the other inner circle colleges.
You guys might as well do a tape change now.
Mine's out. I'll
turn these lights off.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 44. That was minutes 45 through the end of the tape, where we do a tape change. And John talked about the rules of access and the different idioms that one could use to access the different parts of the world, independent of your age or social class limitation.
The definition of idiom, with a quick Google search, is a group of words established by usage as having a meaning not deducible from those of the individual words. For example, it's raining cats and dogs.
It comes from the Latin idioma, special property, and from the Greek idioma, I believe that's how you pronounce it, special feature or special phrasing. Idios, quote, one's own, end quote. So it's a particular use of words that you would use to identify yourself as part of a social class that you might not be a part of. In other words, the words which actually form the metaphorical sheep's clothing that a wolf can wear in your presence. And as we referenced in last episode, the Associated Press was accused of racism after accurately transcribing President Obama's words as he adopted an artificial idiom to speak to some inner city people in the central United States. And then John brings up the idea of crowd control, referring back to the ancient idea of the Roman Collegia, which was controlled by bankers, merchants, pirates, and other criminals.
this idea that we can control ourselves, we can be our own shepherds and keep ourselves in line, and they don't even really have to manage us after they put us through a system where we are our own big brother watching over us, and all these other false ideas that we use and to compartmentalize our minds to believe things that aren't true, and thereby denying ourselves what John phrases as our birthright as human beings. The realization that we have this infinite potential, that humanity has been here, that these things have been discovered, and then they've been secreted. This useful information has been hidden away from the general population and denied so that people can be controlled and ranched like livestock, figuratively and literally being poisoned by the ranchers. And so before we got to the end where the tape changed, he mentions, unless they read Jack London, unless their minds are artificially softened with these things that really don't pertain to what you need to know to survive and thrive in this world. And that comes back to the focus of why exactly are we continuing to support the public education system when, in identifying the form and function and its origins, none of this would ever have been approved and agreed to by parents. And yet we put our children and we put ourselves, I mean, everyone here has been through public schooling, through a system that's controlled by psychopaths, these people who have assumed the mantle of being an expert, but in every way, they are not fit to make decisions on our behalf. Only we are fit to develop our own minds, and I think that what John talks about as far as unschooling or open source education is the answer that delivers autonomy. And then when you have a group of individuals who are all sovereign but working together with common purpose, we avoid things like communism, socialism, national socialism, all these different things. I mean, what happened in Nazi Germany was a function of the Prussian education system being there. People ask, how could those people be so brainwashed? Well, you better ask that question really hard right now, because they are doing to us something much worse than they ever did to the people of Germany. And we need to figure it out, protect ourselves, protect our children, learn to appreciate ourselves, and protect ourselves from people who don't appreciate themselves.
Very well said.
Very well said.
The idea of self-control and the reading and applying that cadence from different poetry and just interacting with different words, and how that creates built-in models or lyrical jazz, I guess he said. I found that very fascinating and true. I don't know if anybody has anything to follow up on that, but it was really all about self-control.
If you study that part, what he's saying, if you break that down and learn to do that for yourself, you will be able to get a job as a journalist. If you take the muckraking skills that he's teaching you through this ultimate history lesson, and then you add that part where you can jazz up your active literacies, you have a ticket. You can work wherever you want. Maybe you can start to change the system by getting the jobs at Forbes or New York Times or someplace else where what you're writing is so compelling that they can't afford to fire you no matter what you're saying. And they will be forced to back down on their irrational positions, because you can have an anchor to reality that is logic, that is able, by definition, to communicate with a wide audience, because that's how language and communication works in the first place, grammar and logic.
And I think in the spirit of trying to make sure that we're constantly growing is to realize that we're constantly being put in these artificial boxes that make us think we've got it all figured out, that we've got this new paradigm, and then that's the end-all be-all. And we tend to rest into a sort of comfort zone when we think all the facts fit together. And so and whether that's a result of the artificial prolonging of childhood, you know, where you have this, as a child, you have the sense of comfort, right, and dependency on your parents. You don't have true responsibility, and that's an addictive feeling in some ways. And the state knows that, so they try and preserve, you know, both with public education, but also with all the incentives for people to be quote unquote dependent on the state. The only danger being
social welfare and all that hot medical.
Yes. The only danger of that is when it can be taken away, then people are left. You know, it's like farmers who are convinced to move into the city, and then they lose their farming practice, or they lose the knowledge of how to farm. And then once they're in the city, if there's not an adequate food supply, again, you're dependent on the state or on the charity of a few. So examining, you know, your surroundings, constantly reappraising your surroundings, right? Knowing that, you know, what you think about diet one day might be different the next day. What you think about education one day might be different the next day, because both you grow as a person and also the resources you're interacting with, right?
But it's important to have a consistent method and to be changing your mind because of new information you're encountering, not because you're changing the method of how you arrive at decisions.
That was going to be my point, is that, so essentially what you're doing is you're not just using the trivium once, you're using it constantly to push in and examine something closely and then to back off and look, to get a wider perspective on it, and not just assume that one perspective is going to be the correct one because it all checks out. Just because you find what appears to be the right answer doesn't mean there's not more out there. You know what I mean? So it's just a matter of constantly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, they're masters at profiting off of that limited scope and sowing that dependence. I was just going to add to what you were saying.
Yeah, and they're really, really good at setting up all these compartments for people to, you know, you could call them rabbit holes or distractions, but all these different things to take people off in different directions with their energy, their time and energy, because they appear interesting or relevant on the surface, but any analysis of any depth, you realize that it's like a red herring or a straw man or something that's meant to essentially waste your time if you're not critically thinking. And it's the same thing with books, right? So the reason you want to have critical thinking combined with your literacy is because if you, you know, everything you read could be true, but if you don't know a process that you can constantly apply consistently that allows you to read something and go, okay, you know, did they just use a fallacious attack? Because everything you're reading is trying to manipulate your consciousness. And if you don't have that filter that allows you to go, oh, you know, some information's more dense than others and some information is, you know, more valuable in terms of its source properly, its firsthand, as opposed to, you know, speculative information. Just that discernment alone will help you be able to have a foundation to be placing all this information and turn it into actual useful knowledge and then communicate it once you understand the logic of it. And that's
well, Paul, one of the things I just want to comment on there that you said is just I think the ability to be able to step back and hold different ideas that might be opposing to your own is such a, you know, something that is
the mark of an educated mind, according to Aristotle.
Right, exactly. And that's something that's kind of been mentioned over and over again throughout the Gatto interview, especially in the beginning when we first started this podcast in episode 41. We mentioned how he argued dialectically, or he argued with himself, and that how philosophers, you know, all throughout time from Aristotle on through have, you know, it's the power of the dialect. And one of the great things I think that's important for people to get out of that is just the idea of not only having consistent method, being able to take that self-responsibility, take a step back, not get emotionally reactive to a situation that they're trying to look at, and just use a consistent method to try to understand exactly what's going on. And that's the most important thing. Instead of trying to change your method or just go on false assumptions, you finally have something that's been, you know, essentially used over time by so many various elite schools. And, you know,
so why would somebody use literacy as a way to foster and strengthen their internal dialectic, their internal conversation of asking these questions, to do something to what Gatto says is he writes it out and he argues with himself? Why would he argue with himself? What is this secret thing that he's doing that no one's ever doing for themselves? Oh, that's a traditional method of arriving at truth that has been prescribed for thousands of years. And in the 15,000 hours of public schooling, no one ever thought to teach you this. I just thought that that's kind of ironic. And these are the things that we have to learn as we listen to these podcasts, because this is a classroom that teaches things that aren't ever going to be taught in a brick and mortar type of building under the current regime and under the current belief systems that we all had been indoctrinated into. We truly have to think outside the box by recognizing that there are many boxes, and we continue to grow through our lifetimes, and that we are each a work in progress that is, as of yet, unfinished.
In other words, when you get your high school diploma, your education isn't over.
Well, and let's just talk about that. What we've learned through the first 4 hours is that jobs aren't hiring people the way that you're taught that they hire people. Colleges aren't accepting people in the ways that you've been trained to get into college and, you know, get through their acceptance system. And that there's a secret, not a back door or anything like that, but there's just a correct path that is most efficient and effective. And they obscure that from our view as everyday citizens. They preserve that for people who pay $40,000 a year to send their kid to boarding school, which means that their parent or parents have to be doing something to sell out into the system and contribute to the overall destruction according to the plan of Cecil Rhodes and the Rothschilds who funded them, right? So there is a really rich fabric, textile, a mosaic, dare I say tapestry of history that has been obscured that's much more interesting than this shower curtain they give us in public schooling, if you don't mind the mixed metaphor at this point. I mean, the idea is that what we've been presented with is so plastic and unrealistic, and that when you get past the point where you're believing everything you've been told and start to look for yourself, it is intrinsically and like infinitely fascinating what you can discover on any given day and how much growth and learning you can do, which only tells you how much each of us doesn't know at any given time. So we have to continue to respect each other and speak with diffidence. We're just discovering this path, but it exists. There are many, many, many flavorful and fruitful, very fascinating artifacts that are here, but have been obscured because we all were taught in such a way that we think we already know the story of any of these given historical events. But when you look at it, that's not how it is.
I felt like that was a great ending. Say something prolific.
Yeah,
okay, I know. I mean, I think that fully explains what you just said, fully explains what he encapsulated in the life and the arc of a life. And getting people to realize that we are all here on a planet in space, and these petty differences and, ingrained.
Dare you say spaceship Earth? I mean, let's use the metaphor. We're all in the same spaceship flying around this fireball. Like, we better figure our shit out as human beings. Otherwise, chaos is going to reign. And that only gives the people, you know, other people opportunities for power.
And I was just going to close by saying that the elites will continue to allow us to have our childhood artificially extended, and they'll provide us with an endless supply of toys to play with and cartoons and stuff to watch. And we're just going to become more bred to be that kind of slave class if we don't start becoming grown-ups in every regard of life. And that process starts with reclaiming your own mind, realizing your own right of self-ownership and self-determination, and applying critical thinking so that as you build your new understanding of how the world works and how to interact with people, you're not only doing it effectively, but in a way that you can share with people, and they'll be inspired, not shocked by your positive transformation.
Yeah, I think you were the one, Paul, where I heard the term. You used amusements. There are how many ever amusements out there, but it's just like it's interesting because
to muse is to think, and amuse is to avoid thinking,
right.
And that's the
prefix,
the tie behind amusement, and that brings episode 44 of the Peace Revolution, the ultimate history lesson, hour 4, to an end. Please join us next time for the continuation and final episode of the ultimate history lesson, Peace Revolution 45. And until then, thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
That's great.
I had to think about that twice there.
It's been a long time coming.
This has been a really long day. You guys are troopers.
Marathon 5 hours, yeah.
You guys, I was ready to call it quits and throw in the towel after the first 15 minutes.
You got to keep moving forward.
And since no one threw in the towel, I was like, well, I'm not going to say anything then. I guess I'm just going to keep going and see what happens.
You guys truly made history today because even though I thought 43 was like the best work ever, we have laid out some work that no one else has ever had the balls to connect in public. And it's telling you about the JFK assassination. It's telling you about all this stuff. Jan, you did a fantastic job on Lawson.
And Kevin and Paul. Yeah.
Thank you for showing up today and doing that, because none of us could have really done it that way. And I think we've laid some history down for posterity, and that generations to come will be pointing to it and be like, look, these guys got it together and put it out there, because independently all these little dots exist, but no one else is out there really connecting them. And that's why I think it's meaningful to take these times and invest these hours in being able to not encapsulate, but to put these things in these ideas and artifacts in a container.
People just like the idea of this roundtable discussion.
Encapsulate, absolutely. Encapsulate, disseminate, try not to hate.
It's not even encapsulate so much as because you're opening it up for people by giving them additional context. You're actually opening these subjects up to them.
open it.
You know?
Well, we're introducing.
Encapsulating it in a way that they can swallow it down and digest it.
It's and. Subtext. Also and, isn't it? Yeah.
Watch the subtext there.
I love it. I love it.
Did you guys watch South Park last week?
That's why I said subtext, because it was the whole musical episode where there's a subtext to all the musicals. And that was
blowjobs.
Yeah, it was truly hysterical. Truly hysterical. Maybe if we had some subtext like that in our media, we would be super popular and be watched by billions of people every week. Can you believe what you see on TV when you do take a chance to look
at
it? There's like hundreds of channels of crazy shit that I cannot believe get funding. And it's like, it's all right there. But you can't find anything smart to watch on TV without commercials.
Dude, I'm exhausted by the end of the night because I have to go through.
It takes longer to surf and find something worthwhile to watch than it does to watch the 20-minute program.
Just critical thinking, like nonstop.
Just give us some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give us some truth. No shortcut.